Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
There is a peaceful solution called peace revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in it. I know we can win it. So let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast for higher education. Peace Revolution and all the media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented without corporate sponsorship and is provided to you commercial-free and free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media host at TragedyandHope.com. If you enjoy this podcast and find it rewarding, please share it with anyone you think might be interested, as that's how we grow. I also encourage you to check out the episode notes, the references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein you can sharpen your intellectual self-defense skills while enjoying a fear-free zone in which to practice these new arts of liberation. Today's episode is going to strategically focus in on a single strategy through which you can learn to better identify the myriad of ways that human beings use language to deceive each other. That's right, we're going to learn how to be our own lie detector. And it's so simple that you'll be left asking yourself, begging the question, why didn't they teach me this in school? Well, that's an excellent question, one I hope you can answer if you've listened to the Peace Revolution episodes thus far in order. And if not, I encourage you to try that out. At this point, I'd like to thank all of those who participate in the Introduction to Logic study group in the Tragedy and Hope online community, as I think our discussion and sharing the process of our own learning will inspire you to really start to catalyze your own potential. This is all based on the concept that education is not finite, and that just because we sat through 15,000 hours of experimental psychology turned public education does not mean that we've been taught that which we need to survive and thrive in this world. I want to offer something which might help you better understand why I invest my time sharing what I've learned, and it begins with the fact that I have confidence in you. I know that if you keep tuning in and exercising your mind, that your innate and natural cognitive strength will become manifest. I understand from the evidence that if the status quo were not so threatened by each and every individual mind, that it would not poison our water supplies with fluoride, nor would it make 15,000 hours of pseudo-education compulsory. It would not be in its best interest of survival. It is the very fact that you have the potential, as does everyone you know, to rise above the conditioned responses which influenced every major aspect of our education system, and as a consequence, of our lives thereafter. It's also worth mentioning that in listening to the other podcasts in our network of independent media producers, you can exercise and apply what you've learned in previous Peace Revolution podcasts. So if your mind is looking for more exercise, you'll find the content of the Corbett Report, Media Monarchy, Gnostic Media, School Sucks Podcast, and Maria Heller interviews to provide plenty of food for thought with which you can then practice your methodology of critical thinking and contradiction detection. Part of the reason we're not taught in school how to recognize lies or recognize contradictions is that it would be practically impossible to teach us the story of how America was founded and how Christopher Columbus was something other than a genocidal plague to the indigenous peoples of this country. In other words, it's not in the government's best interest to teach you or I the truth. That could be done in a few hundred hours. The reason it takes 15,000 hours is something which takes a bit more explaining. And it will mean that you'll have to recognize that none of us were given the truth on the first go-round. But this time around, we've got a little bit more experience from which to draw upon in order to make an informed decision. Further touching on that point, in a future episode, I'll be covering a book titled World as Laboratory, Experiments with Mice, Mazes, and Men by Rebecca Lemov. It's the book used by Scott Noble in composing his two excellent films, Human Resources and Cywar, and the book also covers the topic of metanoia, which is the ever-expanding edge of consciousness, from which Scott takes the name of his website, metanoia-films.org. The book details how experiments on animals led to regulations for classrooms, proving beyond a doubt that the Prussian PhD system and the Prussian education system, which has been adopted around the world, not just in the United States, is a system, but its purpose and form are not indicative of any form of education that a human being would be logically approving of. The point being, with the state of our current education system, before you can even trust yourself to be your own best authority, you must first build your integrity. And integrity is doing what you said you were going to do when you said you were going to do it. And it's a consistent pattern of maintaining your identity through these actions. And it's practically impossible to maintain your integrity if your integrity is being breached constantly by other people using words to deceive you, to take your trust, and to make you do things without your informed consent, which consequently forms a conflict between your integrity and your identity. This is an example of a mind virus, or meme, taking control of your actions. And you might want to learn how to avoid this if the meme is based on deception. In other words, in order to make yourself impervious to the lies of others, in order to maintain your integrity, you must first learn to discern fact from fiction, reality from illusion, logic from fallacy. Your awareness that you are a compassionate being should then draw your observation to the fact that your ability to feel empathy for others makes you vulnerable to those who do not. These are the people who bring you offers of something for nothing, the too-good-to-be-true phenomenon, the faith healers, the politicians, criminals in general, but specifically con men, who undermine your confidence. That's why they're called con men. They undermine your confidence and your trust as a means to their wealth and prosperity. Example, subprime loan crisis, and the people who offered those loans. You want to prevent these sort of people from taking advantage of your good nature. This general awareness that there are those on this planet who seek to prey on our trusting nature is the concept which we could then equivocate to a firewall. It's the awareness that there are viruses of the mind, and now we need a way to specifically identify them and protect ourselves from them and their effects. This next component would be our virus scanner. By learning the definitions of the various viruses, we can then readily recognize them and deny them access to our minds. In essence, become immune to their destructive power. This act of learning, as we're doing right now, is our mind's own immune system in action. The viruses are represented by errors in critical thinking, known simply as fallacies. We want to recognize these viruses or fallacies because it's not prudent to incorporate errors in critical thinking as knowledge, nor is it appropriate for retransmission of this virus to others by speaking before applying a method by which we can validate the contents of our own mind. In simplest terms, it does not benefit you to receive or send information which is not valid, unless you wish to deceive someone. Therefore, in order to identify when you're being lied to, learning a few fallacies can be indispensable, as the only way you can be lied to effectively is for you to believe the lie or refuse to undertake the simple steps to verify the truth. Let me say that again. In order to identify when you're being lied to, you need to learn a few fallacies. The only way you can be lied to effectively is for you to believe the lie or to refuse to undertake the simple steps to verify the truth. Learn how to spot the lies by learning how to recognize the various fallacies, and you'll be left with your integrity intact, and you'll be immune to the regret that comes with accepting lies as truth. For example, there's a very useful and easy-to-learn concept called the fallacy of the neglected aspect. This is where useful information is occulted or hidden from the audience who is being persuaded, and this is done to mislead the audience into forming a false decision before they discover the ruse. To offer a specific example, I'd cite Colin Powell in 2003 in his famous Anthrax Act performed in front of the United Nations. This single speech influenced the masses to support a war which was based on circumstances which had been premeditatively contrived. The neglected aspect being that the men who wrote Powell's speech were well aware that they were creating fiction and that they were purposely occulting truth, which, if the public was aware, the public would most assuredly have objected. Even more specifically, let me demonstrate a pattern of lies, which is only made manifest as a result of the general public being denied their own lie detector in the form of recognition of the various forms of deception. Here's the fallacy of the neglected aspect, again being used to justify a war with Iraq, this time in 1991, a time at which there was little, if any, public support for sending our brave troops over to fight that evil dictator Saddam, who, by the way, was fully supported up to that point by our own government. And here's the clip.
Tonight, it was the most shocking atrocity story about Iraq's invasion of Kuwait.
They took the babies out of incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
But was it true?
2 weeks after the liberation, it became apparent that the story was a complete hoax.
Lyndon McIntyre exposes the big lie of the Gulf crisis and the massive public relations campaign that whipped up war fever in the United States.
Citizens for a Free Kuwait wanted to get public opinion behind a full-scale commitment to liberate their country. So they paid $10.7 million to America's biggest public relations company, Hill & Knowlton, Inc. But early on, their daily polling showed most ordinary Americans didn't care about Kuwait. At the time Congressman Porter and Lantos chaired the hearing on Kuwait, they also headed a private group, the Congressional Human Rights Foundation. MacArthur discovered a disturbing link between the Human Rights Foundation and the PR firm that was selling the war.
The Congressional Human Rights Foundation literally operates out of Hill & Knowlton's offices on the second floor of an office complex called Washington Harbor in Georgetown. Hill & Knowlton provides a $3,000 in-kind charitable contribution to the Congressional Human Rights Foundation in the form of a rent reduction for the office space.
The link between Hill & Knowlton and the Human Rights Foundation doesn't end there. Frank Mankiewicz, vice chairman of Hill & Knowlton, became a director of the Human Rights Foundation. And there are other interconnections.
Citizens for a Free Kuwait donated $50,000 to the Congressional Human Rights Foundation after Iraq invaded Kuwait.
Daylight brings only the digging of yet more graves.
Soon there were reports of mass burials of premature babies in Kuwait, dumped from incubators which were then trucked to Baghdad.
The Iraqis tore the respirators from their incubators.
We had to bury many of people.
And the story didn't just have an impact in the U.S. The United Nations convened a rare public forum.
The hardest thing was burying the babies. I myself buried 14 newborn babies that had been taken from their incubators by the soldiers.
Will those...
In a vote 2 days later, the UN approved the use of force against Iraq. Within days of the UN session, a report on Kuwait by Amnesty International quoted Naira's testimony to the U.S. congressman, and they put a number on the infant deaths, 312. Meanwhile, the U.S. Congress was preparing to authorize military force.
That now is the time to check the aggression of this ruthless dictator whose troops have bayoneted pregnant women and have ripped babies from their incubators in Kuwait.
The House easily approved a war resolution. Then it was up to the Senate.
to authorize the use of United States Armed Forces pursuant to United
In the debate, the incubator story came up seven times.
Mr. Dole, aye. Mr. Domenici, aye.
In the end, the war resolution only passed by five votes. These are some of the controversial incubators. When the Iraqi occupiers heard the story that they'd stolen them and killed babies in the process, they invited journalists into Kuwait hospitals to see for themselves. But the story persisted until independent investigators arrived on the scene.
We were able to go around the hospitals to count the incubators and find that, possibly with one or two that had been misplaced, that none were missing. So none of the incubators were removed in the first place. Moreover, it seemed quite clear that there weren't any deaths which had been deliberately the cause of the Iraqis having gone in and stolen equipment.
Then the picture started changing. The doctor who gave Amnesty the information that 312 babies died revised the number down to 72. It finally settled at 30, of which 19 died before the Iraqis arrived.
The story evaporated.
The video news release, the high-tech PR blurb, Hill and Knowlton generated an audio-video feast of images for the media. And one of the most compelling was Naira.
I could not help but think of my nephew, who, if born premature, might have died that day as well.
She seemed to be alone before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus, identified only as a Kuwaiti escapee. But we've discovered she wasn't alone at all. And she wasn't just a simple Kuwaiti escapee. In fact, just a few seats away was her father, Kuwait's ambassador to the United States and Canada. Naira quickly slipped out of the caucus hearing, back into the protective folds of her family, the extended royal family of Kuwait, headed by the Emir Jabir al-Sabah.
How many people knew that she was the ambassador's daughter?
I didn't. I don't know who knew. I did not know she was the ambassador's daughter.
When did you find out she was the ambassador's daughter?
This is the first allegation I've had that she was the ambassador's daughter.
Does it affect her credibility in your mind?
I think it certainly should have been known at the time of the hearing. It would have had bearing on what she might have said, yes. I think people, members of Congress certainly, and members of the public were entitled to know the source of her testimony, therefore who she was.
If it became known that it was somebody who was closely associated with obviously putting across a Kuwaiti government position at a particular time when public opinion was very sensitively balanced in the United States, at least, about whether or not one should be going to war, it was an evenly balanced issue, then it could well have tipped the balance one way that this was an entire show that was being arranged.
Lastly, I'll define a few more useful fallacies so as you go through the rest of the episode, you'll at least have a rudimentary understanding of what's being learned in the logic study group. But first, I'll provide you with some information and links in the episode notes, which will enable you to start learning a comprehensive type of kung fu for your mind. And if you haven't studied them yet, Jan Ervin did two excellent interviews with Dr. Michael LeBosier, who teaches how to recognize the most common fallacies, providing their definitions and discussion. In addition to these interviews, Dr. LeBosier's website is also quite invaluable as it provides you with some of the concepts that you can use every day for the rest of your life. You might consider learning one fallacy a day, and in about a month, you'll have improved your ability to become immune to fraud exponentially. I've already mentioned the neglected aspect fallacy, which can also be used as a catch-all fallacy, as almost every fallacy depends in some aspect on a neglected aspect. That's why fallacies are important to guard against, because if you're believing something which is not true, it can be costly. Just ask the victims of Bernie Madoff. And as your skills improve, you can move on to specifically naming the fallacies, but common recognition of the concept of the neglected aspect is a key to getting started effectively, and it's really easy, as the examples have hopefully demonstrated. Next, let's observe the concept of the irrelevant conclusion, which comes up several times during the remainder of the episode. An irrelevant conclusion is one which does not follow the premise. In Latin, it's expressed as non sequitur, Recognizing this fallacy is simply done by being on your toes, listening to what is being said, and processing it so as to ensure that when someone presents you with an argument, that their premise and conclusion indeed do have a logical connection. If not, it's a sign that somebody might be trying to trick you. Whether they're trying to do so on purpose or accidentally should then be your immediate concern to discern, as the line between friend and foe in this situation becomes a bit foggy. If somebody's trying to communicate and is not aware of their error in logic, and they're open to learning, they're likely a friend. And if they're being cunning and attempting to create a ruse, they won't be interested in learning from their error in reasoning. And it's your responsibility to recognize when somebody makes an argument seeking your support and using irrelevant conclusions. And you'll learn more about this in a few minutes. I'll also mention the concept of the red herring fallacy, which we covered in an earlier Peace Revolution episode. It's when a statement or argument is introduced which is meant to lead you away from the point being discussed. Likewise, if you don't recognize this, someone's about to take you for a ride, and you're not likely to realize it until after the event, if at all. Much like mosquitoes, fallacies bite you, and you might not feel the itch until after that parasite is long gone. The bright side is that once we identify and remove the viruses in our minds by recognizing our own fallacious thinking as well as that which we might have received from others and stored as quote-unquote knowledge, the performance of your mind will return to normal levels, and with a little exercise you can really start to gain some of that much-needed traction in this world of slippery slopes. Exercising your knowledge and recognition of the fallacies is essential to formulating perspectives which accurately represent our shared reality, and this exercise will increase your satisfaction as a consequence. So it's all up to you, and you are why we all go through the trouble to share this information in a meaningful, commercial-free, and free-to-the-public manner. You have the ability to learn your way through this system, and you're about to have the opportunity to crush the spirit of those who sought to undermine your spirit and your potential. Noting that the Prussian PhD system, which infected the United States and became our education system, was developed by Wilhelm Wundt, who believed that we have no soul, and that his ruling class should train us to serve them as slaves who have been rewarded and conditioned to love our servitude. And all you have to do is ask substantial questions and learn how to identify valid answers, and you can discover and learn anything you want. Fallacies are the virus definitions for your intellectual self-defense, because lies are formed with words, not weapons. This is episode 28, How to Spot the Lie, Kung Fu for Your Mind. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Just for a quick overview, neglected aspect, Peikoff goes on to mention a general fallacy in the nature of like a catch-all phrase or statement. In this case, you assert a fact or you give an argument which plausibly suggests a certain conclusion. The argument sounds fine on the base of it, but you have omitted, neglected some fact, some aspect of the case which you brought in would destroy your conclusion. So you've neglected an aspect, left out a fact. This is kind of the key to the art of disinformation. Only presenting so much facts, but just leaving a little bit of it hidden. That's what I thought about there. So it can only qualify with this fallacy if there is a certain plausibility to it. That's another condition. There has to be something plausible behind what a lot of the facts. They give you facts, but there's still something they're not telling you is truth. So if it seems to follow except that the person has left something out, then it's called neglected aspect. It calls attention to that before you can accept the conclusion. You have to integrate all the relevant evidence, not simply some selected portion of the evidence, which might lead to a conclusion which could be easily overthrown by looking at some other aspect of the case.
Was the occulting of information, and so when he covered this last week, I must have seen this fallacy 100 times this week, right? So I was seeing neglected aspect all over the place. Obama's doing it, you know, they're doing it on the news. And then he's like, this, you know, basically every fallacy could fall under neglected aspect unless you use it in some specific case. So I was like, oh, that's why I found it so useful.
Yeah, because he does go on to mention that later on. But yeah, everything can kind of fall under neglected aspect, and there's a few other fallacies where they're kind of catch the, you could apply that fallacy to almost any statement. But I guess the one big thing here I find important is that it can only qualify of this fallacy if there's a certain plausibility to it. So, I mean, there has to be some type of maybe fact presented, something that would make it seem like it logically follows. However, if you, you know, present some different information, that totally changes the meaning of the statement. Jeff Williams says down here, in this case, you give an argument which plausibly suggests a certain conclusion. The argument sounds fine on the face of it, but if you have omitted, neglected some facts. Yeah, that's Peacock's quote. Cody, how do you know if it is neglected without knowing the information being left out?
You got to use the trivium. I mean, so for instance, the 1991 babies in the incubator story, unless you do your own homework, you're left to believe that propaganda. But if you do even the basic grammar of Tom Lantos, who's hosting the whole thing, or Naira, who's the ambassador's daughter, and her dad testified a couple people before, but they don't tell you that she's the ambassador's daughter when she's doing all this testifying, right? And then the other aspects that come in is that Helen Knowlton and Tom Lantos cooked this all up as a propaganda scheme. So if you're just watching it on the C-SPAN, if you're watching it on the face of things, oh, it's very, you know, appeal to emotion and we have to go justify violence against other people, which is irrational, right? So the fact that they're arriving at an irrational conclusion, once you see that, then you go back and analyze the fallacies and you do the grammar and then you see that it's a total psychological warfare campaign to get a war started.
That's why the trivium is important, because the trivium, if properly used, should remain, allow a person to remain open enough to consider continually ask questions so they can come to certainty about the situation for themselves instead of committing, which could be multiple fallacies in that case, which would be appealed to the authority of the commission that was being stated at the time, what information was being presented there, even though it seemed to be who was a Jewish senator or a congressman, because he really pushed the issue and pushed the idea of the babies dying in incubators and juxtaposing that with the Holocaust and all these different things. And so the whole thing was a stage, and he knew about it beforehand, Lantos. So it's just there's multiple fallacies being committed here, but neglected aspect. The general fallacy where once that information is presented, you could see how everything else falls into place.
It's a short-term strategy based on a work of fiction that purposely keeps out information that otherwise these people know about it and they're omitting it in order to make their case, which is at the base irrational.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the importance here is just having the courage to remain open enough to do not only your own research to come to your own conclusions. And that's where we're hoping the trivium helps people, is that you remain open enough to always consider this, that even people that we, you know, we appeal to their authority sometimes because we might have the time to look into it for ourselves, but knowing that information completely changes the historical context in which it was presented. And that's extremely important, because then we can start to see through a lot of the things that are going on right now, especially right now. So he gives a couple examples, like a doctor would argue as follows: this patient has such and such a disease caused by such and such a virus. The liquid will kill the virus, therefore let's give it to him. So that sounds plausible until you bring in the fact that it will also kill the patient. Actually kind of what goes on today.
I mean, that's the prescription that the Federal Reserve runs. I mean, they're basically like, well, let's do this and let's do this. Never mind that it kills the country. It'll save the country.
Save themselves. Just keep whoever's rich and powerful in power.
Right, because they'll move someplace else and feed on another population.
That's why they, you know, go with the gold standard 1 minute and then jump back to fiat money. And it's just this game back and forth that just keeps the same people in power. And that's because nothing, again, everything's being argued from the irrational foundation, because what is money and how's it being used? No one wants to seem to define something as basic as that. It figures it should just be understood as it is. But, okay, so neglected aspect in statistics. Peacock says liars, damn liars, and statisticians. they will come, for instance, and say, do you know that you have 5 billion germs in your mouth? You know, it sounds terrible and frightening. What monstrous disease do you have? But it's perfectly normal and has all types of functions. Having this 5 billion germs won't kill you. It's part of, you know, biological system. Somebody tells you there's a foreign country that's implacably hostile to the U.S. Its population's just risen 50% in the last year. Sounds impressive, but when you find out it's just a man and wife who had a kid or two, that changes the whole perspective. So 3 million people unemployed sounds disastrous, but might be U.S. or Monaco, or babies included, or cancer patients. So as many facts you'd have to get to before you know how to interpret that data. Statistics are played by all the time, and politicians, and they try to use certain statistics to back up their claims. And the statistics themselves, you have to understand how they're interpreting the statistics, the population sample they've taken, the way they've conducted the questionnaires or whatever it be. So there's so much that goes into it. And that's where, again, we go back to treatment, just allowing one to remain open enough to continually consider what they might not be telling us. So
Cody asks, are statistics the number one tool of sophism? I'd say no. I'd say the number one tool of sophism is solipsism, asserting that there is no truth in the first place, therefore they can, you know, basically justify anything.
Well, solipsism,
which would be Kantian philosophy.
Right, yeah. And what, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't solipsism where the content of one's own mind is what can be real or established, isn't on the basis
right,
of
which is basically what quantum physics is all about. So that's the big, the real fine line is, you know, logic is all about recognizing things without contradiction, but quantum physics is basically Kantian justification for everything being a contradiction.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, those are great, great interviews with David Harriman. I really enjoyed that. I'm glad he went into Descartes a little bit in the first one, and I'm glad he got a chance. Yeah, I appreciate it. A chance to talk about string theory and kind of the rationalist argument behind it. I never heard that before, so I really like that. Okay, so I guess a form of neglected aspect here is what's called special pleading or slanting. So what you say is true, but you withhold relevant facts and just push the facts that lead to the conclusion you want. Debaters are very often guilty of this. Just take a side and push that one side, ignoring the issues on their own side. I just think the left-right paradigm is just so obvious in this example, where what the Republican Party, what the Democratic Party pushes, you know, do the government, do you spend money through the government, or do you allow the free market, supposedly? They push these things without defining either, and the machinations behind doing so. He goes on down here, mentions politicians, newspapers, not only doing the editorials, but also, he says, in their factual cases. So,
what about FDR saying on December 7th, yada, 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 Pearl Harbor, when in fact, you know, his office had access to the knowledge that they were attacking Pearl Harbor for days before it happened? So he can't come out and act surprised if he's also like, oh, by the way, my office had briefed me on all this, but I didn't do anything. Wouldn't it? It would get the opposite effect if he actually told the truth.
Yeah, the key there is telling the truth, though. I wonder if there's something behind that. I mean, he goes on here to state the Vietnam War, which I guess Peikoff is for the Vietnam War. But he made an interesting point that, you know, something about the attack. Saw the news every time the Viet Cong made it in the Vietnam War, about the morality of which I do not enter here. But regardless of whether you're for or against it, there were cases where you could tell a newspaper's editorial position simply by the facts it presented in regard to that war. So all the news every time the Viet Cong made an advance, nothing whatever. American or South Vietnamese side made an advance. Whenever some atrocity was committed against the North, pictures and sob stories and so on. Whenever the atrocities were committed by the South and North, there was no mention. So, but yeah, it goes on to no mention who started the war in the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which McNamara later said, like, well, I guess ships were attacked 2 days before, but it wasn't a massive torpedo. Yes, McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense.
Or it's like Clark Clifford, who is the one who convinced Truman to recognize Israel, or Clark Clifford, who's the one who convinced Johnson to let the USS Liberty go down like that. So there are, you know, people associated with national security that commit these fallacies as a living, it appears.
Jeff Williams, and it's because recognition of this fallacy that you spread to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, because a partial truth can be misleading. Yeah, I mean, this is all aspects of, you know, disinformation. So when Rich says, like, some people get paid to lie like this, so that's the art and essence of mind control and disinformation, which perpetuates mind control. So in this case, special pleading or slanting is being just more, you already understand it explicit in a way what you're doing. So I guess we kind of hounded that over. I guess we'll just jump to a relevant conclusion unless anyone has anything more to say about neglected aspects.
The only things I would have to say about the neglected aspects are non sequiturs. So we can go on to irrelevant conclusions.
Right, I think non sequitur kind of falls under that. So irrelevant conclusion, use only in desperation when there's nothing else to say at all. So in this fallacy, you don't commit any other fallacies. You may even prove your point conclusively, convincingly, but there's a problem. The point is irrelevant to the point you're supposed to be proving. That's I had in bold. So you started on one issue, and you're proving something besides the point. Peikoff mentions this. It's sometimes called the fallacy of the non sequitur. Latin for does not follow. So example, segregation must prevail before it can be proved scientifically that human beings differ in all sorts of ways. on the face of the statement has no plausibility behind it. What's the relevance? What's the difference? How do you follow from that there should be segregation? No attempt to make a connection, you'd say irrelevant conclusion. So diverting the issue, changing the subject, the attempt is deliberate to change the subject. It falls under irrelevant conclusion, just more detailed. So an example would be like, religion is a good thing, why? Man needs to be certain of something. Suppose he somehow proves man needs something and proves it. It's completely irrelevant and non sequitur, because it's irrelevant to say religion is good because the question is why religion? Of all the possible things you could be certain of. Like, why would, in this case, well, man needs to be certain of something, but why is it out to be religion? Why can't it be something else on which man is certain that gives him more justification to his life or whatever? So
I think he meant that one to be ironic because it does, you know, religion and certainty are antithetical, whereas he's trying to teach logic, which is how to attain certainty.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because in a way, there's a
contradiction. This course starts with why does man need logic? So I just detected him, you know, poetically pointing that out.
Well said. Well said. So the trick between distinguishing between neglected aspect and irrelevant conclusions, they're both extremely general. So the only real distinction you can draw is in the case of neglected aspect, the argument has a certain plausibility on its own terms until you bring in the facts that the person is leaving out. So it seems to follow once you have those hidden or occulted facts, you could say, then it changes the understanding. So in the case of irrelevant conclusion, it doesn't even on its own terms have any plausibility. It's simply irrelevant. It doesn't follow on the face knowing anything else. So that's kind of the difference if you juxtapose those two different fallacies against one another. It's hard to distinguish because what seems plausible to one person will seem completely insane to someone else, and therefore there are certain options here. But if somebody says, if all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Napoleon lost the Battle of Waterloo, it does not follow. So it's just a matter of like what's used in an extreme case. You can very easily point this out.
But 2 + 2 = 4, therefore Saddam Hussein is the son of God. See how crazy and irrational it sounds? That's you recognizing the fallacy.
They use that more and more, though. That is flown around all the time, and people seem to find that certain statements will follow when, in fact, they don't at all. And it's important to be able to catch up on that. That's why I said it's subtle.
Obama promises change, but since he never defines change, it's all a non sequitur.
It's like the defining the green movement. I still haven't figured that one out either.
I bet if you interviewed people who supported Obama's change campaign, every single one of them would have a unique definition of change, just like every single one of them has a unique belief in God. Nobody believes in the same thing.
You have to define and be able to identify the change and what he meant by change. And I guess that was never – he just kind of an appeal to emotion, really.
Cody asks, how does trust relate to the use of logic? And my attempt to answer, the reason that trust is associated with the use of logic is because it's able to be experimentally and predictably repeated, and it follows along a pattern of repeatability. And Jeff Williams says, yes, inductive.
So, yeah, I mean, they're both general and they both can be subtle, and you just have to – it's kind of an art to apply more or less correctly when it needs to be. So some more examples. Some educators claim that coeducation leads to distractions which interfere with the students' work in class. Reliable tests show that there is very little difference in mental ability between boys and girls. So what's that got to do with it? How does that follow from your first claim? Some educators claim that coeducation leads to distractions. So your viewpoint is false. What do you mean by viewpoint is wrong? I have a right to my opinion. It's a free country. Debate, blatant change of subject. The question was, do you not have a political right to assert your opinion? The question was whether or not your opinion was correct. Extension is a common form of irrelevant conclusion that is its own special name. So extension, a relevant refutation gets its name because what happens is an individual puts forth a viewpoint that somebody wants to refute, but instead of refuting his viewpoint, the opponent extends or exaggerates his viewpoint into something that the person did not say, and then proceeds all pomp and circumstance, classic Peacock, to demolish the exaggeration and to conclude that he has demolished the actual viewpoint.
So there's like a chain of fallacies together. It's like the fallacy of the irrelevant conclusion, which can be continued into the fallacy of extension by creating a straw man and destroying it. And all of this can be used as a red herring to lead you off the trail if you don't sniff it out and start calling it out. Before you know it, you're all the way over here in a place where whoever is arguing with you is trying to take you, and you don't want to end up in a place of irrationality. Logic is the anchor.
well, right here we have a relevant conclusion in this form of an extension, and it's just exaggerating the point that you're trying to, you're exaggerating the viewpoint into something like the person or whatever, whoever's saying it, you know, didn't say, in a way that forms as a red herring, a straw man, to lead you off the trail and put up this weak argument that has nothing, look over here, when in fact, you know, if you blow over the straw man, it doesn't hold up. And like, I guess it goes again to Neil's point of like, many times you find that there's overlapping fallacies, especially in analyzing an article or listening to someone speak. Like, many times this is a good example of how like one fallacy kind of, you could argue, presupposes or leads to many different fallacies. So there's usually one broad general one that it falls under, and then you can find more specific fallacies in between there. But yeah, this often leads to a red herring in the form of a straw man because of the idea of extension or building up or exaggerating the person's point that leads it off the trail of what is supposed to be refuted.
You have to be careful because there's like a slippery slope of fallacies that this can all just roll into. The point is, what you're noticing is numerous layers of errors that, from, you know, when looked at various perspectives, are illustrated by certain fallacies. So it's not just one-dimensional. You can kind of look around these things at individual fallacies in sentences, and then composition fallacies as a result of taking different fallacies in different sentences and in a paragraph. You see what I'm saying? So there's a cumulative.
So they continually build. Yeah, they. Right. Yeah, I get exactly what you're saying. Yeah, and that's. I mean, I like how you said like it's a slippery slope of fallacies, because once you identify possibly a broad or even a detail, say you find a broad fallacy and then you start hounding out different fallacies within the details of certain sentences that lead into the paragraph, and the paragraph itself then becomes a more generalized fallacy. So it builds upon one another many times, and that's why I can kind of. And once you start building up all these fallacies, you can make them all explicit if you need to, if you're arguing with someone. But at the same time, you can just also realize more quickly that the point being made here is irrelevant, and they're, you know, might be taking you off topic by exaggerating the point or something. It doesn't matter. You just know now that they're in some way not getting to the point or identifying anything or not being truthful or holding contradictory statements. So it's more for us more quickly to realize if we're being, you know, lied to or a bunch of BS is trying to be sold to us. So Jeff Williams goes on here to mention, it is blowing up the argument, something is not. Red herring differs from straw man extension in that it changes the argument instead of blowing it up to a larger argument, I think. Yeah, I mean, a red herring is just
But the red herring starts with the irrelevant conclusion. If you don't catch on to that irrelevant conclusion, all of a sudden you're being sent on this red herring string of other fallacies that gets you off the trail.
Red herring is like the big catch-all for like where a lot of these different fallacies, because there's many things that, at least how I've seen the, like a taxonomic kind of breakdown of it. It's like red herring, then you have all these different versions of red herring, but yeah, diversion,
misdirection.
So Rich already mentioned form a straw man technique, then it's easy to blow it over, but it doesn't prove anything, but the initial position is irrelevant. So I'm against any alteration of the principles of the American Constitution. You can't be against everything new, and goes into a long speech about the progress and importance of change, none of which you deny. You made a specific observation that he's refuting and extended an exaggerated version of it, so it makes it irrelevant. Technology has immeasurably improved man's life. He comes back and says it hasn't made everybody wealthy overnight, but besides the point, he never claimed it had. So distinguish irrelevant refutation, this extension, which is a form of irrelevant conclusion, from a perfectly valid technique of reason. So he said there's such a thing as reductio ad absurdum. That is not a fallacy. So it's a valid technique of refuting something, which means simply reducing it to the absurd. The pattern is, if you accept such and such, then you're forced to accept such and such, that this consequence is absurd. Therefore, the original position which led to it is false. That is valid and is not extension, not a relevant conclusion, if the consequence that you claim was implicit in the original position. But it really has to actually be implicit. If the consequence does actually follow, then you can refute any position by showing it leads to absurd consequences. So an example would be like someone argues Medicare is wrong because it leads to socialized medicine or embodies the principles of socialized medicine. And socialized medicine is bad, therefore Medicare is bad. He says which is perfectly valid if you can show that the fact Medicare does involve the principles of socialized medicine and ultimately lead to this. Then that's an example where it wouldn't be extension. Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree. He only said he'd go over 22 informal fallacies, and most of them had the Latin root names or other ones he considered to be. I mean, Dr. Lebrezier, I believe, when Jan did the fallacies, he has different, like 42, I believe, when he had the two fallacies episodes on his Gnostic Media podcast. And so there's a lot, and we go around just searching different websites. There's many different, like 20, it's usually between 20 and 40 lists in between of different fallacies. A lot of them will just have like a taxonomic breakdown, like red herring, and then under red herring we have a bunch of, like, we just said a bunch of different versions of red herring, like a straw man or a diversion or something like that. Or equivocation could lead as a general to taxonomic breakdown to different groups and sections within. So I don't know, that's how I use it. Most of the time they relate 20 to 40 informal fallacies as far as I understood. There's no end to making as many fallacies you want technically. But it's just the ones that are more common than people actually fall for that I guess Peikoff decides to go into. So if anyone has any suggestions as far as like maybe ones that Peikoff left out we find to be important or...
Well, I thought his observations that the neglected aspect fallacy and the irrelevant conclusion fallacy could be catch-alls. And to me, when he said that, I didn't think of them as catch-alls so much as the red flags that let you know that a fallacy is to be found. Right, when you know some piece of grammar that's not being offered by the argument, that is letting you know that there is a neglected aspect, and you can go in detail, but you're already recognizing what that neglected aspect is because you have awareness of that piece of grammar. And then with the irrelevant conclusion, once you understand when somebody's trying to argue a point that you're following along, once they go off that road, it's your job to halt them and call their attention to that, or call the audience's attention to that. Because that's where, you know, things get irrational. There's a lot of irrelevant conclusions and non sequiturs in, for instance, the Nazi ideology.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. If you're able to make it explicit much faster by using the trivium and logic, then you can more quickly, if you're in an argument or just trying to prove something, you can more quickly get back to the point of the matter instead of getting on this large sidetrack of stories and exaggerated claims and neglected aspect that, you know, you could solve the problem if you just had that one small piece of evidence. So yeah, that's extremely important. And I like the fact, like you said, it's a catch-all, and that's what he implies, that you can look there. I mean, sometimes people use fallacies and there's actually something behind what they're trying to prove. They just don't have the proper method to back up their claims because they didn't have logic or aren't good with the rhetoric aspect. It's a good way of trying to get back on track sometimes. So people, and that's the idea of when you have to find out that people are trying to use this and they know the fallacy and are still using it, then they're trying to deceive you. But if not, then it's just a matter of helping get back on the topic you're trying to prove or come to an understanding of. Skipping the branches to go after the root, exactly. Saves a lot of time and gets a lot more work done.
It's like dismissing the arbitrary.
Yeah, right here. A miscellaneous catch-all. Every fallacy could be called a relevant conclusion. So from the fact believe it, they're committing barracunium, it's irrelevant, doesn't follow. It's true that a man said it ad hominem, it doesn't follow that it's false. So if you're going to use irrelevant conclusion on the broad sense, then there's only one fallacy, irrelevant conclusion only. If you're going to make the special miscellaneous fallacy, it's the last thing you would call someone or some argument. You call it irrelevant conclusion when in essence nothing is said about it except it's simply irrelevant. It's besides the point, it doesn't follow. So yeah, just to get back to what Rich said, like it's the idea of it's a catch-all. It can help at first identify certain problems, and then you can lead to more specific fallacies within the structure of the argument being presented or the proof. So, okay, I guess...
Let's move to the homework, and what we'll do is read out the question or read out the statement, and then we'll talk about the answer. That way we have a complete record of examples and the attached answers that we can share either through Jan's podcast or Peace Revolution or both.
Okay, great.
I think that would give people good traction to start using these things and finding the value easily.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of us doing this now is so we can hopefully be more readily able to apply it. I bet the more easily you can come to identify this type of false rhetoric being used all over the place. So, I mean, and these were from the 1970s, late 1970s. Number one, until you are omniscient about yourself, you cannot know for sure whether or not some part of your motivation, presently unknown to you, is basically evil. For the present, you have no proof on this point either way. You must, therefore, admit that it is possible that you are, to some extent, basically evil. Someone on the floor would like to take that?
That's argument ad ignorantiam. You can't disprove a negative, and the responsibility, the burden lies with whoever makes a positive assertion.
So yeah, relevant application of the proper principle is the man is innocent until proven guilty is ad ignorantium. The application of ignorantium in a legal or moral sense, so it's just a different aspect. So, you know, according to Peikoff, this one is very, it's widespread and it's one of the bases of self-doubt from people who have that problem, who have self-doubt not because of particular things that they name, but because they generalize, how do I know I'm not no good if I knew everything about myself? I'm a very common attitude and classic case of ignorantium. So suppose you lose contests all the time, are justified in feeling self-doubt. No, but it depends on what kind of contests and why you lose them. That was a comment made in the crowd on the lectures. So depending you're doing your best at every contest and you continue to fail, self-doubt in this case is a fundamental metaphysical judgment on yourself to be effective. So if you say you are no good, nothing that can warrant such a judgment if you are in fact doing your best and are intellectually honest. There's no standard of performance you could arbitrarily set for yourself and say, I must be able to speak French better than my competitor, or make more money than my rival, or finish my book faster than someone else. Otherwise, I'm no good, and it's setting arbitrary standards for yourself. So he just kind of goes in to break it down a little bit more. So number three, long hair is superior to short hair. As proved by the consensus of distinguished youth leaders, how do you determine who is a distinguished youth leader? That's easy. They all have long hair. Anyone? That's right, Dave. It's Petitio. Does anyone want to go into why it'd be Petitio? Or what kind of Petitio?
It's Petitio because it has an arbitrary definition, but when I read the first sentence, I treated it like two different people saying the sentences, so I labeled the first one verecundium because it's an appeal to authority of proved by the consensus of distinguished youth leaders, right? So I thought that was verecundium. And then how do you determine that a distinguished youth leader? That's easy. They all have long hair. So then I realize it's Petitio, arbitrary definition of youth leader.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think someone in the crowd, I can't remember, but I thought someone had the same thing where they thought it was verecundium. And like if you dissect it in that way.
I liked that person when they asked that question because I was like, oh, they're thinking just like me. But they're wrong. So we're both wrong. We have that in common.
Well, not necessarily wrong. The way you analyzed it actually would be correct, wouldn't it?
It so was if vindicated.
If you separate it that way, it's technically correct. So arbitrary redefinition. So yeah, here, what is said verecundium at the fallacy simply stopped as follows. Long hair is superior is proved by the consensus of distinguished youth leaders. Stop before that. So yeah, you're exactly right. But yeah, in the case of the entire phrase, it ends up being arbitrary redefinition. So even if you hadn't begged the question on the issue of whether long hair or short hair is superior, it's not something of a technical kind that it would be appropriate to appeal to experts or specialists to begin with. And the idea of this example in hair, consequently, you could say within that respect, even without the circularity, the petitio involved, it's fallacious on the grounds of appeal to authority. If you look at it from the point of view that you just said, Rich, so does circular reasoning enclose within its arbitrary definition? It depends upon how you use the term circular reasoning. Sometimes use this synonymous with any petitio, in which case, obviously, this would be a form of it. But yeah, Peikoff goes on to mention that he uses it in reasoning as a specific type, this being circular reasoning. He uses that just as a specific type of fallacy, which does not involve re-arbitrary definition, but starts with a proposition, then going to another one and more, and then ending up with your original. So it's kind of putting links into a chain, a rusty chain, like I like to say, in which case there would not be that particular form. And that's what circular reasoning would be. Number four. Your arguments against Red China's system of government are completely worthless because you haven't even been there.
I think generally this is a red herring, even though Peikoff doesn't explain it that way, because here is my justification. This person's trying to respond to your arguments, right? And he's saying they're completely worthless, and then he's going to mislead you with whatever he says next because he's not answering the question. He's not addressing it, right? So red herring, generally, and ad hominem abusive specifically. Because it's not necessary to actually be there unless it's something that you have to see, smell, experience for yourself that there's no other record of way of knowing about.
Wait, so you say generally it's a red herring, but specifically it's an abusive ad hominem. That's what you just said. Because like, and then the fact that the red herring comes in from saying that because you haven't been there, you can't know. And it's diverting the fact that you can come to certain conclusions about China beforehand just based on what you can read or what you've seen in history or again, I mean, I can't argue against. I think that's a good point you make, Rich. That generally you could look at this as a red herring, diverting the point of the argument you're trying to make of China's system of government, which has been talked about as nothing new. It didn't even start with China, the philosophic ideas, where those came from. I mean, that's diverting your attention to the idea that you haven't been there, so you can't know. And then the more detailed is when they say, in this example, completely worthless, or your China system, your arguments against China's system of government are completely worthless. It's attacking the fact that it's worthless because on the red herring that it's you haven't been there, which is just diverting the point. So yeah, I can totally see. And again,
and worthless is also a valuation, and the metric by which he's deriving his valuation is fallacious because he's saying you haven't even been there. Well, that doesn't even make a difference in the decision. So, like, there's all sorts of dynamics caused by the error in thinking.
Exactly. I mean, in this case, if you're commenting on some aspect of the culture or a specific region, then, you know, and you're just talking about how the people live in that region and so forth and so on, and that someone's been there and has firsthand experience, it's obviously going to change the game. But in this case, when you're just talking about China's system of government, I mean, all the information is available and has been available about that system of government. You can make an argument for it without ever being there. And then from there, you can start to state many different fallacies, more general and detailed. So again, it says snowballing effect or cumulative effect. Number six. Okay. My friends, the only cure for the present energy crisis is the nationalization of all oil and coal companies. Once and for all, we must put an end to the diabolical conspiracy of the profit-mad, power-lusting vultures of big business. Don't let the tycoons wrap their slimy tentacles around our nation's economy and squeeze it dry for their own aggrandizement. Don't let people sink their blood-drenched claws into the helpless, exposed flesh of the American people. Yeah, Dan and Melissa, Simeon, and both, yeah, and Jeff. Dave appealed to the devil. Yeah, I mean, in this case, it's ad populum. It has nuanced and loaded words, but yeah, essentially leads back to argumentum ad populum because of all the emotive terms. Exactly, Jeff. So, like, everyone nailed that one pretty fast. We'll go on to seven. Every person acts at every moment to achieve the maximum personal pleasure. That is the sole human motivation. What about Mr. X? He just went into the desert for 10 years to mortify the flesh and lie on a bed of nails. There's no argument against me. That's his way of achieving personal pleasure. How do you know that's his way of achieving pleasure? Well, it's obvious. After all, every person acts at every moment to achieve the maximum personal pleasure. That is the sole human motivation. Yeah, in this case, it is Petitio.
By arbitrary definition.
Right. And someone said circular reasoning. Again, circular reasoning, I mean, you could say Petitio and circular reasoning could be broad, but the way Peikoff describes circular reasoning is something that's specific. I mean, you could say this is circular reasoning, and under circular reasoning is re-arbitrary definition because he just restates the beginning of his argument.
Which makes it subjective because he's like, that's his way of achieving, you know, personal pleasure. It's not an objective perspective. So it's irrational.
Exactly. It is irrational. I mean, arbitrary definition, the person is defining the pursuit of pleasure in such a way that anything the person does qualifies for the pursuit of pleasure. So, so at the beginning, you think that by pleasure is a specific emotional experience distinguished of all other possible motivations, and he redefines pleasure so that anything a person does qualifies as his personal pleasure. And you ask him how you defend the definition, he then just restates his thesis. But in this case, it would actually be subjective and not objective. Therefore, it's arbitrary.
So essentially, if you find yourself in a conversation that resembles that, realize that you are talking about nothing and that the other person doesn't really wish to communicate. They just wish to read aloud their dreams. And if you have time for that, fine. And if not, dismiss the arbitrary and move on.
Well said, yeah. Because once you identify So what you're trying to come to a conclusion about or identify is arbitrary. You're not talking about anything at all then.
Because
if identity
was established, this person wouldn't have anything to say because the only reason that they have an opinion on this is because they have some irrationality going on.
Dave says, I remember Petitio being that you use the premise as your conclusion. Please explain arbitrary definition. Okay, arbitrary definition, it's begging the questions of Petitio. but it takes the form of arbitrarily defining some key term in the argument. So in accordance with the thesis at issue, in order to make the issue impregnable. So a person puts forth a statement, somebody else points out a counterexample, and then the original person immediately switches one of his definitions in order to save himself from the objection. So he usually just by he, she recites the original thesis and the main point of dispute. Yeah, so I guess in the question segment, someone asked, I guess Peikoff answered, like, when you say that a person redefines it, it does not imply that he had to at the beginning give a definition and then officially give another one. He may give no definitions at all. You simply determine from the usage of that his original statements counted upon or assumed one meaning, and in the course of the argument, he switched that meaning. So it doesn't require that he formally gives a definition, but the definition is kind of implied in the statement. So Dave down here says, no, I meant in terms of how it pertains to Partidio. Well, I guess if you re-arbitrary redefine the, you're begging the question by not actually looking at the premise and kind of concluding how those premises relate to one another. So yeah, you change the by changing the definition, you change about what's being talked about.
Yeah, sorry, he's given it. It's when you give it multiple identities. It's kind of like equivocation.
Yeah, I mean, this could fall more broadly under equivocation. This, but yeah, I mean, that's exactly. It doesn't necessarily make it wrong, but sometimes you over-identify, so you end up still begging the question that you haven't proved your original point. You continually redefine the point at issue without backing up your claim. So this. It just continually begs the question. You still have to be able to prove the claim or premise you're putting forth. And just by redefining it isn't the proof. You have to be able to identify and through logic come to understand.
So begging the question is being begged because the person begging the question has not gone through the process of identification, answering the five W's plus how, and establishing any sort of knowledge.
Again, this comes back to just all these fallacies relate back to identification. Okay, so an example would be, I hope this is the right one, Jeff. I have a new view, all Christians are virtuous. See, I think that's the one we were talking about. So in this case, what about Mr. Jones? He's a member of such and such denomination, but he's deeply involved in the manufacture of LSD and runs the mafia in his neighborhood, etc. Doesn't that refute your thesis that all Christians are virtuous? Not at all. Mr. Jones isn't a Christian. Well, why isn't he a Christian? Because he's not virtuous. To be a Christian, you have to be virtuous. Why? How do you justify that definition? Well, that definition must be justified because all Christians must be virtuous. That kind of gives another brief example. In this case, he actually more or less defines in the statements being given how he's redefining the use of what is a Christian.
Cody asks, isn't that hasty generalization? But I would say that it's judgment without observation.
Judgment without observation creates hasty generalizations, does it not? Without observing and identifying something, you're just generalizing based on, and it could be anything arbitrary in this perspective. Okay, cool, Dave. Yeah, I hope that helped you out. There's some more examples if you'd like me to give you some more, but that's the basis of it. And that's why it's still begging the question, because you're just redefining the original thing you're trying to essentially, one of the premise through which you're trying to come to your proof, so. Yeah, in this case, it'd be what is virtuous is begging the question. Or Christian, actually. He redefines the Christian aspect.
Well, it also goes to the definition of what is virtue, because the two are not necessarily tied together.
Right.
You know, you have
Christians and virtue, yeah. Go ahead.
You have needs, and based on your needs, you derive virtues and priorities, and based on how you want to interact with other people in context of your virtues and priorities, that's your morals and your ethics. Right. So I don't even agree that those two things are put together well in that sentence to start off with. There's lots of virtuous Christians. There are few virtuous Christian leaders. Let's say.
Yeah.
That.
There you go. Okay. So to go on, number 9, Croce, philosophy of the practical. The Inquisition must have been justified and beneficial if whole peoples invoked and defended it. If men of the loftiest souls founded and created it severally and impartially, and its very adversaries applied it on their own account, Pyre answering to Pyre. Anyone have one for this one?
I got a bunch, so who else has
some? Melissa says Vericundia and Populum.
I have Vericundium twice. I have a Petitio begging the question. I have a circumstantial ad hominem. And my second Vericundium is qualitative.
Wow. Do you want to go over how you broke that down, if you remember?
Let me attempt. All right. Inquisition must have been justified and beneficial if the whole peoples invoked and defended it. So that's the first Verecundium. If men of the loftiest souls founded and created it, that's alluding to that these people are moral experts, which is the second Verecundium of the qualitative variety. It's severally and impartially, and its very adversaries applied it on their own account, pyre answering to pyre. So that last part is a petitio, the begging the question, and it's a circumstantial ad hominem because it's talking about the adversaries.
Yeah, like the if men of the loftiest souls founded and created it, how it's a Verecundium, but in this case it's qualitative on the fact that they're very moral. I mean, that's subtle in an aspect, so it's important. And again, I like this example because of how many fallacies can be picked out, and he wanted that to be shown that, you know, one statement being put forth or proof being provided doesn't mean there's just going to be one fallacy. I mean, I think Neil did a good job a couple weeks ago when he just stated, like, you know, there's many different fallacies and they continue to accumulate, and you can pick through, find broad and detailed ones in each of these cases. So. Okay.
You want to just touch on number 10?
Sure. Actually, I guess I didn't have that many. It's okay.
I got that one. I'll just read it because I did it for fun.
Okay.
Are you a progressive who's in favor of basically changing the American political system, or are you one of those conservatives who believe that nothing in our present political system should be changed in any way? And I was like, well, that's obviously a complex question and a false alternative. But I wasn't sure, so I just wanted to. False dichotomy. That's what Cody says.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely a complex question. And what was the other one you said? False alternative?
False alternative, because it's not necessarily either one of those.
I forget the fallacy, the one where it makes it either or could also fall under that one. False dichotomy, Cody. Yeah. Begs the question of what is progressive and conservative as well.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, that's a good point, because you, one of those conservatives who believe that nothing in our present political system should be changed in any way. That totally makes sense. That's a good point, Cody.
It's, you know, it's the complex question and false dichotomy, because it's like, is this the first time you've beaten your wife? Either answering in the affirmative or the negative establishes something that's not true.
Establishes what's already being asked in this loaded question, which makes it a complex question in the first place. Because the fact, it's kind of like incriminating yourself in that classic Greek example. Because no matter if you say yes or no, you're still saying you had done it at one point. And in this case.
Well, it sounds like that's what they base the read technique on, of interrogation, right? The complex questions and, you know.
That's completely right. But I mean, just in general, that's how litigation many times is done when you're.
Depositions, you know, all that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah. They're trying to incriminate. They're trying to get you cornered into a situation where however way you answer is still going to somehow bring it back on you.
And that's why this is intellectual self-defense, because there are people out there trained to do things to you that you don't even understand yet. And, you know, learning a fallacy a day can, in a month, give you the protection that you can use effectively for the rest of your life.
And there's no chance that you'd have to truly try to not use this, because once you have it enough in the back of your mind to make a lot of these fallacies explicit, it's everywhere. So we'll get enough practice just, you know, living our lives. So it's important that once you just get to a good basic 20 or so that you can remember pretty quickly, you can more easily be able to make them explicit.
Because you're at least getting some traction. You don't have to know all the fallacies, but if you get a good grip on 5, 10, 15, 20 of these things, you will have – because here's what I noticed, just a little personal observation that I've had in the past 12 hours. That because all these corporate media companies have fired their investigative journalists, now that people are coming out and using logic in the trivium, some of these places are trying to respond to it with the people that they've hired as replacements who do not have any intellectual self-defense skills and are very, very ill-skilled to uphold all these giant lies that they've inherited. So I sense a tipping point going on when we are the ones learning how to do the journalists' jobs. And the people that are being paid by these corporations are basically leaving themselves defenseless, which, you know, as soon as we all get to learn logic and spread it with other people and teach other people, I think it becomes a moot point, anything they do, because it'll be so obviously flawed. Just like all the recent press with Obama and Osama and all the questions over all these actions that are going on, people, if they were, if it was, I agree, it's psychological warfare is going on, but I would observe that if really, really, really smart people that we had no help but catching were running it, we'd never know. And the fact that it becomes so obvious at this skill level that we are reaching, what's going on? I mean, that's a serious tipping point.
Yeah, people say that critical thinking isn't the foundation that's needed to make a change, but I say it is the only. I mean, the way to come to learn anything yourself, learning the trivium, and essentially just learning logic on this basic level, what we're doing now, and being able to realize just the mass amount of lies that are being, we're being inundated with every day.
Well, it's a mass. Let's depersonalize it. It's not the mass amount of lies. It's the mass amount of noise that we're all labeling as signal, right? Let's not dehumanize it or judge. Let's just say that we're all being inundated with noise, and we've all been trained to take this noise as signal. And when you take noise as your signal, you're not going to get very good, satisfaction out of your actions. But as soon as you get tuned into the signal and you can figure out how to tune out the noise in the form of recognizing fallacies, dismissing the arbitrary, applying logic in the trivium, then you can work with 100% signal all day. And it's such a difference in your ability to efficiently and effectively deal with the chaos and confusion of daily life.
And even if this material sometimes, especially history, is tough to look at, if you continually use the trivium and logic in specific and you remain open enough, you'll be able to come to identify certain events that you may not want to look at, but it does give that peace of mind that you've been able to identify for the first time what has been more or less hidden or occulted from us. So I think that's also another thing people say. There's many critical thinkers that would never agree with a lot of the stuff we talk about, in Tragedy and Hope, but I would just say it's because they're not properly applying their critical thinking methods. Because essentially what we're just trying to get down to identify the exact cause of the effect of what we see around us right now, especially in history, and how it leads up to the events that are going on.
You want to hit number 13?
Number 13. Smith will give you a number of arguments as to why you should vote for the Democratic candidate. Don't fall for them. Remember that Smith has been hired by the Democrats and that he himself votes Republican. It's Jeff's right, but yeah, most of but they're both homonyms, right? But it's circumstantial ad hominem in this.
And it's abusive.
This example. And, is it? I guess I didn't catch that. So yeah,
the way he's saying, don't fall for them. Remember that Smith has been hired by the Democrats. Like, that's a bad thing, and that he votes Republican himself, which means he's a hypocrite. And in my terms, well, if they're circumstantial, it's not as directly abusing the person as their circumstance, which is still an ad hominem. But Jeff could be right. Anyone?
Many times I think it can be subtly defined in this case.
Well, but I think if you can prove that the person is being a hypocrite, if you can substantiate your statement, then it's not an ad hominem. It's only an ad hominem if you don't have readily evidence available right there to back your claim. I think that's the real issue, is being able to back when you point out that somebody's a hypocrite.
Agreed. So the statement as it is, calling the guy a hypocrite without presenting the step-by-step method by which that conclusion was derived or validated by their mind, would lead one to believe that without that information, it's an ad hominem. But I agree with you with what you're saying, Jan.
It's also a point to me that if you're going to call him a hypocrite, it should be made after you've already established the fact of why, or established your proof as to certain claims the man made is incorrect and actually shows a hypocritical nature. Because you start calling it a hypocrite first and then you back it up later, that's still correct, but people might get turned off just by the fact you start calling him names before you proved why. And so that's important too, the order in which you present that.
Because at the end of the day, we have to understand that we're not doing this as a hobby. We're doing this as a survival and thriving skill in this world, because we understand that our compassion makes us vulnerable to those who would lie to us, right? So if we don't have this lie detector in the form of logic and identifying these fallacies, we're left open to predators every day, which I don't think is very civilized or very adult. Once you see what's going on, you got to take some action.
It's a peaceful way to deal with predators in this sense, because the predator's really acting on our mind, especially more so now.
Well, the predators control other people with words. They use the ruling powers, the non-elected ruling powers, method by which they control people is through rhetoric and through words. And so when you can attack them on that basis peacefully, you never have to go to the irrational physical side where you're playing in their game of irrational war. Because, in that case, it's all stacked against us. They've got resources that you don't even want to compete with. However, when they're faced with playing on our battlefield, That means all these other people got to go crack the books and start doing homework and become more human again. No, that's not so bad. That's a peaceful revolution. But you cannot go fight them on the battlefield that they want to choose. I mean, this is basic.
And the lie detector is a peaceful way to do it. This learning critical thinking to see through the lies before we react emotionally and become involved in such irrational processes, such as war.
Right. And when you study Sun Tzu or Machiavelli or von Clausewitz, what you understand is that that's working from logic and reason and making your enemy to be irrational. We already have an enemy that's irrational. So like, we do have a superior advantage if we choose to use it. We're using it right now.
How ironic is that, though? The fact that, I completely agree, but just insofar that we have a superior advantage if we decide to use it. And like, we can all employ that right now if we just so choose. It's a matter of getting this meme out and getting it understood as to why it would be effective.
And Jeff says, and to clarify, this method isn't perfect, but it does give a great degree of certainty, or, you know, in a situation where nobody's working with degrees of certainty for the most part. So
yeah.
Any degrees of measure or metrics is better than nothing in this situation. And as we find better ways to measure these things, then we'll probably adopt them if it doesn't take away our humanity.
Right. And the idea behind the trivium is that, I mean, I remember Gene, when we had the trivium study call, he had a good point that, you know, the trivium is a crude method, but it is still a method. It's the best method we've been able to identify and use so far, because we don't have literal telepathy in the fact that we're hearing each other's thoughts in our heads. We can't then.
Well, and we can make a 10-step method, but the 3-step method that mimics how nature and all life in nature learns on its own, it's a good fundamental first step.
Yeah, exactly.
And let's not make it too complicated. 3 steps. Everyone can handle 3 steps. There's, you know, very few people on this planet who are living and eating every day who can't handle 3 steps. You know, there are some people who are mentally incapacitated or have had injuries where they're in a coma. I would say that the 3 steps aren't going to work for them very well. It's not their issue. But for everyone else who's out there acting irrationally, these 3 steps literally can save your life.
And also,
if you examine your life.
Well, we made a comment last week as to how the trivium also mimics the way our brains naturally work and function, and as we grow up, being a child through adolescence to adulthood, like how our brain develops seems to mimic this way of education as well.
Well, let's just think of the fallacies that we've inherited in form of like things like the virgin birth, right? There's a 3-step method to reproduction. It's sex, pregnancy, and birth, right? You don't have birth or pregnancy without sex. You don't have birth or sex and just have pregnancy, right? Like, so these three things are connected. It's a 3-step process that repeats. And so the reproductive process on which nature designed itself, or however it came back.
Oh, that's cause and effect in this case.
Well, that's logic. That's reality. Yeah.
Because by being able to identify this 3-step process, in this case, the analogy of birth, and in this case, the virgin birth, I mean, the fact that it's supposed to be a miracle, you know, the immaculate conception.
It's the wrong M-word. It's a metaphor, but it's not a miracle.
Yeah.
It's not
exactly. Or an allegory in the form of a metaphor.
Why would God create laws of physics and then defy them? That doesn't make any sense. It makes more sense that if there is a creator, that the creator will be really brilliant and just build everything into the differential equation which represents this whole place.
And ignore Marguerite Rigliozzo in this conversation as well.
Yeah. I was going to say, because I remember reading the comments from your podcast. I didn't listen to that one, though.
Well, she actually believes in real parthenogenesis. I think she's like...
Yes, yeah, she does.
She's... You know, her first book was really good, but her second book, it's like she actually started believing that shit. Somewhere along the line, it became her religion.
Yeah, I remember watching a thing when she was... It was like a little conference where she was talking about her newest book. That was right at the time when you were having her back on the show. And I was thinking... When I was watching this, I mean, she made a statement like, oh, don't ask me what I think you are about whether or not I believe it's possible. I mean, you already think you guys already know my answer. So she's implying within that statement that somehow, I mean, she's totally bought onto the idea that there can be this parthenogenesis or this divine birth or divine conception.
There is parthenogenesis. It's called cloning. Where you reproduce yourself without a male partner or an opposite sex partner. So, like, you know, so that's cloning, what she's talking about. And if you take cloning way back in time or artificial insemination, like, if you include time travel, if we're going to get irrational, let's play with time travel. That's my favorite toy. If we're bringing irrational toys on the table, you had a time traveler that went back and artificially inseminated Mary there. But that doesn't make him the son of God. So it doesn't help. It doesn't help the end result.
Totally changes the story right there.
And time travel really makes the idea of, you know, religion interesting, that somebody would go back, drop off these codes, let them evolve the world, and then take power from it. So that's irrationality.
Time travel itself is, well.
Time travel itself.
Yeah, I won't even
resolve.
Get into that.
No, seriously. The irrationality of time travel is this, that it only results in a world without the trivium because it's regret that generates the need for time travel, because if you did it right the first time, you wouldn't want to change things, right? So it's only in a world without the trivium and a method to attain certainty that people would have so much regret that they would risk destroying themselves to go back in time and do it. You wouldn't need a machine anyway. You could do it with a philosophy.
Well, using trivium and analyzing history, couldn't that be your time travel machine? And then realizing the mistakes and the opportunities that present, Tragedy and Hope, but that present us. I mean, in that way, it actually is a, we have, you know, a time machine right now. If we decide to use it, now we can't get the perfect facts of history, but we can get a general picture of what's happened. Seem to paint consistent points in history, kind of self-repeating points. So it's the idea that there's, you know, civilizations, they begin, they rise up to power and they fall usually through overextension, or it could be a number of different things, but you can analyze these same patterns in history and, you know, take yourself outside of them if you don't want to participate. And we get people to do this on a mass scale, it'll totally change the game. There's your time machine, if you need one. Dave, time travel is circular reasoning in action. Yeah, essentially. I mean, the time travel presupposes that time is linear. Well, I guess it doesn't have to, but if you have a literal machine and you're going back in time, it presupposes that all these events are going in one straight line.
Wouldn't the discovery of time travel predicate two things? It takes time from being linear to nonlinear, and it means that whoever just discovered time travel would immediately have it stolen by a ruthless cartel group, because they would wait around and wait for somebody innocent to naively discover such a thing, and then they would just take it and use it. So it's not a good idea.
Actually, this kind of brings up a point. Well, I mean, it's a little bit off topic, but the singularity that Colbert did this past week on his podcast, just going over Ray Kurzweil and a lot of the transhumanists and the idea of the singularity, when we have to merge the machines, not going over the implications of the negative effects that, you know, more control, the fact that, you know, a nuclear bomb will not even be considered a very powerful weapon when you have tiny little robots that can self-replicate. So,
I think the idea of putting all those elites in a little box and keeping them there, like on a hard drive, that's their idea, right? That's pretty clever that something that nature got these guys to think that the coolest thing would be to put themselves on a hard drive so the rest of us could grow hemp. I mean, that's brilliant in and of itself right there. Go ahead, make yourself into a virtual character inside of this already virtual holographic machine. Go ahead, put yourself in another box. We'll be out here growing hemp.
Amen. God, that's
I'll get your nanobots to help us too, because nanobots know what's up.
Yeah, if they want to be in a virtual world where they can do whatever they want, by all means, go ahead. Well, we can be in this virtual world right now doing growing hemp, making it sustainable and lasting rather than what's being done to it now. But alas, I dream. We dream. Okay. So number 14, obviously hard work is undesirable. A poll has just been taken which shows that the great majority of people definitely dislike hard work. Right, yeah. It's a quantitative because it appeals to, you know, the great numbers, the majority. A poll has been taken which shows that the great majority. So, yeah, it's an argumentum ad verecundium in this aspect. This one was pretty straightforward.
I also have ad populum, because no matter how many people agree, it doesn't make it necessarily the truth.
Yeah.
So they're looking for the truth. In other words, polling is not a method by which one attains knowledge of actuality. That just tells you what all these people have been programmed with. If that's your goal, that's what polling does, right? But if you're actually trying to find out what's really going on, you know, how would you know among those 100 people which one or two of those people actually had done their homework and weren't just parroting something they heard on the news that day to look cool?
In this case, in this example, one could presuppose the other because of the way it's stated. A poll has just been taken which shows the great majority of people definitely dislike hard work. Appeal to authority and the fact that a great majority of people, but at the same time appealing to the populace that's a great majority of people, could appeal to a large group of people in this example. And so they both presuppose each other, and the way it's stated kind of implies both fallacies.
Well, and there's another error, because it starts out with its conclusion. Obviously
hard work, right.
Hard work is undesirable. But I would bet most of the people that were asked actually did hard work. So even though they didn't desire it, they were hardworking people. And the two really aren't connected, so it's almost like an irrelevant conclusion. You know, because he leads with a conclusion, then he provides irrelevant information to justify that conclusion.
Yeah, the great majority of people definitely dislike hard work. But obviously hard work is undesirable. So yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Here again, we showed this as a tiny little statement. We can build up many different fallacies. Stating it in such a way that says, obviously hard work is undesirable. I can't remember the fallacy, but just in the way he states, first off, obviously hard work is undesirable.
It's somebody trying to trick you. That's one of the keys of recognizing the fallacies. When they lead with that, they're like, obviously, it's like only a mentally incapacitated person couldn't see this, this sort of thing. And he's not even presenting any information. So it's there to abuse you with the words and not give you any relevant factual truth.
Cody says on here, great majority of people jumped off the bridge, so jumping off a bridge is desirable. So, I mean, yeah, it's as basic but as truthful as that. And we see that all around us as well, appeal to authority or appeal to popular belief. I mean, that's everywhere, especially in the form of religion. That's where I think of it the most. I guess there's a little statement that a couple people made underneath this example. John Stuart Mill put together this. He wanted to show that pleasure is the only good thing, the only desirable thing, and argued that the only proof that something is audible is that people hear it, and the only proof that something is visible is that people actually see it. Well, the only proof that something is desirable must then actually desire it. People actually desire pleasure before pleasure is desirable. This goes to the statement, which he said, John Stuart Mill, in this example, that which is undesired is undesirable. This would be an example of equivocation. The only proof that something is desirable must then be that people actually desire it. People actually desire pleasure before pleasure is desirable. In this case, is the fallacy of equivocation, but it's on the part of a word. In this case, equivocation on the suffix. So audible means capable of being heard. Visible means capable of being seen. That type of fact can be established by the fact someone can see or hear it. But desirable does not mean the ible, does not mean it is capable of being desired. It means that it ought to be desired, should be desired, right to be desired. So it's relevant if people do desire it. Mill was appealing to people's actual desires to establish what is desirable, which is verecundium, but did it. It made it plausible on the equivocation of a suffix. It's interesting to think of how just on a suffix that changes the way the word is understood in the context of the statement.
And it means you have to have a greater attention to detail, which is not paranoid, because people are provably trying to do this. Even if they're not consciously trying to do it, they are programmed by the system we live in to do this. Cody has a question about how the mainstream media uses polls to promote opinion and talking points, right? Jeff points out Yahoo uses this trending now. I would say that YouTube uses a type of polling system. So when you see the green bar and the little red bar, or the big red bar and the green bar, that is a percentage of the people who have actually watched the video, who took the trouble to click, and it's like a ratio. So in that way, it's kind of meaningful. When you extrapolate it up to the mainstream media, the only time that mainstream media provides you with a poll is when they are trying to direct the herd. So even though we, as human beings, are fallible and we tend to cling to favorable polls, 90% of the people are aware that 9/11 is an inside job, or, you know, polls like that, right? At the end of the day, they're all kind of loaded, and you really shouldn't look to polls in those types of situations to figure out your truth. What you should see is a poll on a certain topic. You should go investigate that topic on your own and then see, you know, compare that to the poll, right?
It's like scientific way of kind of get you to fall into fallacious.
It's the initial observation. It's not the process of thinking that you use to make your judgments. But after you make your informed choice, then you can see, oh, I'm in a minority or a majority. And then you can even say that's, you know, not necessarily credible, because you have to investigate who took the poll, who paid for the poll, who was polled, how were they polled, where were they publishing the poll, what purpose. You know, you have to answer all these other questions. And that's where you have to learn to dismiss the arbitrary. If they're given a poll on something that does not matter to you in your life, you don't have to take the time to investigate it. But if the poll is related to something that's going to legally affect you, because they're going to pass this legislation and you need to get informed, well, then that's something that, you know, you might want to put your time into.
Yeah, I mean, what was it? Irrelevant conclusion went over statistics examples, and that's a perfect example where statistics – I just bought a book called How to Lie with Statistics. And it's a small little thing. It's pretty old, but I was looking through it, and my dad referred me to it, and I just found it interesting. I just picked it up, but the idea is just, I mean, if you don't understand the population size of the people, the population where they took the certain poll, how they conducted the questions, who paid for it, and all these different little factors that, you know, it does take more time to identify and realize those. But at the same time, if something is going to affect your life, you think that's going to, if you have a, it's like Jan said when I interviewed him, if you believe that your choices have an effect on how your life relates, then Trivium and Suffering have this idea that if, you know, if your choices have some weight to how your life is being lived and how what you experience in life, then the Trivium is a great way of coming to more certainty, identifying what you want to need to both live and thrive and, you know, continue on. So with 15, I'm going to read it real quickly. And yeah, we'll just go from there because it's be quickly. My lawyer, Mr. Green, says that I should settle out of court and not prosecute because the law in this case favors my opponent. Since Green has a law degree from Harvard, 30 years of experience in the field, and a large and successful legal practice, I guess he should know what he's talking about. The chances are that his advice is correct.
There is a fallacy in there that Peacock misses.
Well, in this case, well, Jeff, why isn't it a fallacy before we jump into Rich's fallacy? Right, he actually establishes why he should be able to trust him when, in fact, his own, in this case, he doesn't have time to do his own research. Why, you know, he establishes kind of the ethos of why he could be justified in, you know, relying on this man for information. Rich, why don't you go ahead and state what fallacy?
The statement does not include the information as to what line of practice the attorney is. So Mr. Green could be a divorce attorney and you could have a patent case. And so you're asking him because he's your brother-in-law. And he's free, you know, it's free. So there's not enough information in that statement to have, you know, enough certainty, in my opinion, when you could easily find that piece out. You don't want to take your patent to a divorce attorney.
Yeah.
Unless you want a divorce and your wife, you know. He runs off with your wife. They split the company. That's the scenario you're going to get into if you, you know, take the wrong information to the wrong type of attorney.
That's a really good example, actually, because within law, there's so many different – you kind of specialize in very small aspect of law.
And Cody says that begs the question of what is his experience, right? Well, the idea is that's – you know, I can't tell you what his experience is because Mr. Green's a fictional character that Leonard Peikoff made up. So it's up to Peikoff, who's making this assertion that it's valid, to provide that information, in my opinion, before we could say it's a valid statement.
It's a good observation, Rich. Well done. That's another good point. And then it's a neglected aspect. Right, the guy neglected to tell you all the information about his expertise and why, you know, he should settle out of court and all these different types of all this evidence he gives, you know, why you can trust him.
He could have had 30 years of lost cases, says Melissa.
Yeah, wouldn't that be kind of like a neglected aspect?
Exactly.
Yeah, so. Okay, moving on to number 16. Of course, it's wrong to argue against conscription. You'll be drafted if you do. Like, this is pretty...
Well, it's a moral argument that's being made that's being enforced with force or fear of force or fraud.
It might make sure a scary big stick and try it ad baculum, appeal to the walking stick. So, yeah, I mean, in this case, this is extremely straightforward, I thought. So we'll just jump to the next one, number 18. All men want love, no matter what they say, because man's need for love is universal. How does Melissa Simeone down here says... how does arguing lead to the draft?
It's an irrelevant conclusion. And that's irrational, and so is the use of force or threat of it. But to answer your question, Tony, I'd say it's petitio and a restatement, and there's a claim being made that is not justified or identified in its identity. One of the keywords that you have to look at is when someone says all, that's a red flag, because in very few cases are all things bad, generalizations, right? So generalizations are...
Even universal in this case is kind of a generalization.
But when you hear a generalization, it's likely that it's a hasty generalization that hasn't had a thought put into it. Because when you hear a generalization that does have thought, you actually do want to hear that. That's something good to know about. All bears have the possibility of killing humans or something like that.
I just finished Ayn Rand's philosophy, Who Needs It? And in there she's got this whole thing towards the end of the book at like... this stereotypical European and then the stereotypical American, and it was a total hasty generalization fallacy, like the whole paper was. So here she's talking about logic, but she's using this whole hasty generalization as the foundation of her logic.
Yeah, it goes to show that even people compounding on the need and use and importance of logic still many times argue fallaciously in their own right. Actually, we talked about this last week when Neil brought up the fact that one of this, he was listening to a radio station. They were talking about the Osama bin Laden and the conspiracy theorists and how absurd it is. Yet, and he was selling a logic course, right? So, I mean, it's the idea that trivium, you know, the trivium is taught in Catholic institutions, some Catholic institutions. So, I mean, yeah, they all, but if you leave yourself open enough through critical thinking, I mean, you can stop at some point and start acting irrational. And over-rationalize just means you don't really identify anything, but you're just trying to rationalize your own point at stopping at a certain conclusion, which happens all the time, especially amongst intellectuals, because they feel like they've come far enough to understand a certain topic. When, if you use correctly, you try to identify and get on the same page with everyone.
Cody notes that the use of hasty generalization is a stereotype, because the definition of stereotype is a conventional, formulaic, oversimplified conception, opinion, or image. So it's like a stick figure, where, you know, as opposed to a photograph.
That's a good point. It's like taking small sample sizes to reduce statistics, because that from a small sample size, they sometimes will project to the larger perspective, which doesn't always mean it.
Well, it's
correlates.
Like when you talk to people who demonstrate racist tendencies and you try to get at what the root cause is or what the experience was, it seems like they're generalizations are hastily derived at an early time under a very small sample of circumstances, and then they're applied. That hasty generalization is then stretched out because it's already been generalized hastily, and it's just clung to without ever looking at it again, because then they'd have to realize that part of their identity is not something that, you know, is...
And then sometimes they try to use logic to back that up, when in fact the logic could be used to tear down the whole argument in the first place.
And that's
especially
building castles in the air, because it's the fallacy of the stolen concept to try to use logic or rationality without, you know, using the law of identity to base that on.
Yeah, exactly. Dave Vanessa says etymology of stereotype, 1798, is a method of printing from a plate, from French stereotype, printing by means of a solid plate of type. Wow. Noun meaning a stereotype plate. Image perpetuated without change, 1817. It's first recorded 1850 from the verb in this sense, which is from 1819, meaning preconceived and oversimplified notion of characteristics typical of a person or group. It's recorded from 1922, so stereotypical is a test from 1949. Hmm.
Just something that came to mind while we were discussing all this. Why is the law of identity important as a foundation, or why is an objective perspective more useful in communication than subjective? It comes down to communication and having, you know, agreed on definitions. Because if not, if each person is just making it up on their own end, then there's very little communication going on, but it gives the illusion that there's a huge amount of communication going on, but it's not actually occurring.
Well, you're trying to identify with what they're making up, and what they're making up is just their own.
Right, because
you know, it's just a content of their own imagination, and therefore, like, it's the idea of, like, coming to objectively identify something, even if people want to be subjectivists, like, if they still can hold enough logic to understand that, like, you can recognize that this is a ball and the ball rolls, something so simple, like, you can then communicate about, you know, the characteristics the ball might take, or saying if you're putting in a golf course or something. But it's that simple. But if you're talking about something they're just creating, you're trying to identify, you're trying to objectively make out what they're stating to you based on what is either in the content of their own imagination, their fallacious rhetoric about what they're trying to prove in reality by different types of fallacies. So,
well, and here's where the clash comes in, because when you have two people of a subjective persuasion communicating, it's like one is making up their own language and symbols and everything. You know, it's not the alphabet. It's just, you know, stuff they make up. And the other person receives it and acts like they know how to read it. And they play this game back and forth. And if one of those people comes into contact with someone like logic, the logician or the person who's practicing an objective perspective says, well, let's define our terms and try to get down to this. And they're like, no. If I define my terms, then I'm not going to be able to communicate with other people who play this game with me. Right. And so it's
it's
a
like
game
the entire
of pretending.
Game being played right now. I mean,
sure. That's why.
Isn't that why we're trying to, I guess, in a way, you know,
like events go on and the people
thinking.
On TV who talk about the events have no clue what they're talking about. And yet they're the people who are being paid millions of dollars and put in front of millions of people. That's the hypocrisy of the status quo.
And the fact that millions of people actually buy into it, which goes to show.
Well, I'd go one step further and note that the status quo is not intelligent, because it's not self-recognizing its own folly. we on the outside who have broken with the status quo can readily recognize it. But the status quo is bound to basically terminate itself in the way that it's been, you know, irrational over the past century.
Well, over time, it eventually it's the only course it can lead itself on. I mean, that's been the overwhelming, if you analyze history, what it's leading towards, essentially, especially right now.
When I think the bailouts, the too big to fail, that whole idea is the biggest, you know, sign of the irrationality. Because for a long time in human history, if your actions were out of line with your needs for survival, guess what? You died. There wasn't some, you know, some 300 million people who, you know, fund this bailout solution for you. You know what I'm saying? It's like survival of the fittest crowd found out that they're not so fit now. And now they're like, oh, well, we'll just, you know, play dirty.
Well, you know, it's interesting to note that we have this illusion of technology around us. And obviously it is around us. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just saying, like, because we have so much technology around us, we kind of take this self-inflated version that we're so much smarter than people in the past. And I seem to think that might actually be completely different. Whereas, although not as many people got educated in the past, the education they did get, the little bit, was based on a lot of times grammar and logic. And, like, the fact that more people are more easily swayed and led now, especially with the massive information, and I think TV and advertisement being used as a form of mind control, has actually numbed us down more so. And we're more willing to accept than people in the past, at least certain centuries.
Well, it's simple to see, because in the past, they knew that they didn't know. They knew that there was so much going on that they couldn't explain. But today, with the internet, people think they have the illusion that they're informed, when really they just have a bunch of data that doesn't have any logical connection to each other. So it's not information. So therefore, you are not informed.
It can be made into information. I mean, you
absolutely
can,
but you need
to organize
that
chaos, right?
Yeah, methodology.
And that's why, you know, people argue with us, and, you know, people in the Trajano community and other places, and Jan's work especially, because Jan was the first one to expose the trivium with Gene, and, like, they'll argue that critical thinking isn't a realistic method. But, I mean, just how many times have we hashed out the fact that, like, people aren't identifying any of the problems that present us and are taking all these irrational, sometimes arbitrary concepts, which you're talking about nothing then, so nothing gets done, and that's exactly where we're at. I mean, we have about 1,000 – we have people, you know, as the analogy goes, hitting at the branches and the leaves but actually not going for the trunk. And going for the trunk requires people to, you know, take some responsibility and come to learn. It takes some time, but it's not, you know – doing our best to put in a more cohesive, greater understanding. It is the foundation, because we're just saying this is simply on a basic level how your mind works.
And I would gladly dedicate some of my time to review the work of somebody who argues against critical thinking and yet has cogent communication skills and passes knowledge effectively. I would be enthralled to see that. So let me know if anyone finds a link. I've tried them all, man. Michael Sarin, David Icke. I've tried to listen to that stuff, but at the end of the day, I see a pattern of dysfunction that could, you know, overcome.
Well, there's underlying assumptions they make, usually in the form of the nature of reality, the metaphysical question. And those assumptions kind of, even though they do sometimes great work and they have great factual information from history or symbology, and Michael Sarin or with David Icke, with just he does a good overview of the connections of the secret societies and all that and so forth.
Well, you can reflect it back at them, too. This is what's interesting. You can use the mirror. So I could say something like, yes, reptiles do exist for David Icke, but they don't exist for me, right? And so what's he going to say to that? I mean, even if you mirror back their own irrationality, it's like leaves them
like
a paradox that's bigger than their books.
Yeah, I mean, you can even make it, I shouldn't even say this, more complex from the fact that, like, we all have a reptilian brain that we evolved with naturally that has this basic instinctual drive. So you say all these people having these crazy visions show these basic instinctual drives, you know. So I just sit there and think, I'm like, this is a total...
You just have to be wary anytime somebody's like, just grant me this one miracle, and then I can tell you how everything here in this universe works, right? Because it's like David Icke's like, if you just grant me this one...
Big bang.
Yeah, right, any of them, right? It's like, okay, grant me a miracle. I created you as an avatar on my machine, and I'm walking you around the planet Earth right now, David Icke. All right, that's my belief system. How do you like that? Right? Because it's just as arbitrary as asserting that there's reptiles and aliens and all this other stuff, when all I've ever seen evidentiarily in objective reality is human beings playing tricks on other human beings using words, fraud, force, and fear.
It's a form of dark sorcery. That's how it works. Yeah, the Big Bang is a perfect example. And I do believe it has hurt physics because the theory, the philosophy behind it, it doesn't allow them to go any further. They can't identify anything objectively. And therefore, because you can't go beyond the Big Bang and ask those questions, God forbid, pun intended. But yeah, no, it's just...
It's the Pope who forbids going past the Big Bang and inquiring.
That
was from Stephen Hawking.
Well, the Catholics created the Big Bang.
Yep.
Indeed.
The finger of God.
They literally did. They're the ones that came up with it.
Yeah, right. No, it's a Catholic priest that came up with the idea of a Big Bang. That was in 1947, 49, something like that. I forget. And it was used to over-rationalize the point that it's still anything that can be described beyond the Big Bang, you know, perfectly allows the Catholic Church to make any assumption beyond that. And people, it's funny that Catholics and Christians are against the Big Bang when it helps presuppose their own creationism. So
it's like this, too, you know, in geometry.
That's because they're too stupid to realize that the Catholic Church invented it and it didn't come from one of their own. So they all go out and fight against it, thinking it's a scientific theory when they should get behind it.
Well, when I was in Catholic school, they taught us evolution. They taught us the Big Bang. But they did so in a way that it helped bolster the already, you know, preconceived notion of creationism. We didn't take the Bible. The way they described it to us, they never took it literally, but they tried to use science. And if anyone watched, I watched a good documentary, Why I'm Not a Christian Anymore. I forget the name of it. I think it's like Why I'm Not a Christian that Rich sent to me. And it was very, I mean, although he jumped to atheism, which I wouldn't say you should just jump immediately over there, he gives a really good, the way he used logic to come to his conclusions, even though he was terrified of what he might realize. I thought it was a very good story about how you can be open enough to come to identify where a lot of these stories come from, what they mean in an allegorical sense. How even science and relativity theory and quantum theory especially is used to prove these, you know, miraculous states of existence or possibilities that could happen.
Well, and it's your way of freeing yourself of frauds committed in the past so that you can find out what actually exists. That's pretty cool. It's a good opportunity for people to, you know, use what God gave you in the form of your brain and check that, you know, check into life instead of checking out.
And, you know,
beliefs like checking out. When you believe something without actually having gone through the steps of identification, that's, you know, that's checking out.
Yeah, exactly, Jeff. Aristotle's quote, an educated mind can consider an idea without accepting it. Yeah, that's perfect. Great. And
the way that Jan explained it to me, because I understood that one way, but then he's like, he started using a mini DV tape. He's like, you don't have to become the tape to think about it and to observe it and to see its parts. And I was like, at first I was like, what are you talking about? You don't have to become the tape. And then I was like, oh yeah, dude, you can inspect something without it becoming you or you becoming it. You know what I'm saying? And I think too many people are scared by, if I read this book, it's going to do this or that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you had somebody from Ayn Rand on your show. Oh!
Sorry. Oh, just look what Jan just had to go through with, was it Brian Giles or Gills? I forget his name now, but... The guy who
There was a few of them, but he was.
Oh,
the
really?
Worst. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize there's some other ones, but.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of geniuses in the fucking world.
It's like without studying Ayn Rand's work or Leonard Peikoff's work or whomever, you know, some people are like, you can't look at it, you'll become. No, actually, by better understanding it than the people who were writing it in its flawed, you know, presentation, like Ayn Rand, there's a lot of brilliance there, but she's not right by any means on all these things. It's not done. There has to be more thinking. Just like we discovered, you know, where Peikoff's like, this is a valid statement. Because Peikoff doesn't use the same methodology of thinking that we do. So we observe things and think about them before we come up with this, where he's like, I'm going to write a valid statement. He didn't actually break it down and think about it. He just assumed.
Here's the best way to put it, you guys, and this is right out of Ayn Rand's book, the book Philosophy, Who Needs It? It's like right in one of the first chapters in the book. She says you have to study all of the philosophies so that you know your enemies, so that you know who's on your team and who's not and all of that stuff. So, you know, it's like it's funny because I totally agree with that, you know, that you got to read the material so that before you can intelligently attack it or debunk it. So, you know, and not only that, but she's got a lot of good fucking ideas in that book. She's against, you know, B.F. Skinner. She's against mind control and, you know, against like all of this, like, you know, this fascist attempt of dumbing down and homogenizing mankind. She's, you know, very clearly staunchly against all that, and she argues against all that stuff throughout her book. So, you know, to sit there and say, oh, well, it's entirely bullshit, that's stupid. And I did, I fell into that trap because when I lived in L.A., I had this piece of shit boss who was a randroid. And now what's funny is he's a Mormon, but he just converted, but he would go around and ran this, ran that, Atlas Shrugged and blah, blah, blah. And everything is materialism and ego and money. And, you know, so when I left that company, I had this major negative revulsion to anything related to Rand. So like when Gene told me you've got to study Peikoff and Rand, I'm like, you're fucking kidding me. You know, so it was a big, you know, talk about coming full circle there.
Well, you know, there's a lot of important points made with what you just said and the fact that we have to remain. You had so many when you were arguing with Brian, just for example, and you brought up the point that you can't, don't attack the messenger, attack the message after, you know, identify. You don't have to become the message, but identify it first, what's being said in it. And then you can, once you understand it, then you can go ahead and say what you believe is could be wrong with it or provide some proof in those contexts. But, cause, I mean, you've had on people on your show from all different walks of life. I mean, you have a bunch of scientists in talking about psychedelics, and you've had independent researchers of all different types going into mind control, but also, you know, what we were just talking about with parthenogenesis. And all, I mean, you've had so many different people, and you can't take their whole message as truth. You just have to take the bits and parts and try to understand where they're coming from so you can better then identify where some of your rationality comes from, where some of these people, their beliefs come from. You know, you have to be able to identify it. You don't have to become it, but you can sit there and analyze it and identify what it means to you and that your relationship to it, and then move on from there. And that allows for a peaceful resolution.
I was just going to add, Tony, sorry. The best, you know, and like Rich just stated that I taught him this, and I just want to reiterate it, you know, the best way to think of a concept or an idea is to pick up an object in your hand and you look at it and you analyze it and you set it back down. You know, you didn't become the object. You understand the object. You gained understanding by studying it. But you put the object down and you can integrate what's valid of it and not and disregard what's invalid as you wish by having picked it up and studied it and putting it back down.
And what's important is Jan took my implicit understanding and made it explicit through what I even thought at the time was a silly. I'm like, this is silly, dude. And then I got his point. I was like, oh, it's not silly anymore. That's cool. You know, so we all just have to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. And we have to give others the benefit of the doubt. You just have to focus on separating the signal from the noise, which is what all these fallacies, you know, in practice are all about when we learn them.
And they all lead us to act irrational when we become manipulated by them.
And you can only be manipulated by them if you, but listen, I mean, you can only be manipulated by them when you fail to identify them in the first place.
Because yeah,
once you know they exist, that's like the immune system. It's like the virus definitions for your virus scanner, which is understanding the fallacies.
Yeah, that's perfectly well said. Yeah, I mean, it gets back to identification, right? Getting back to being able to objectively identify something in itself and communicate with someone else on that basis. So, I mean, it all goes back to identification. 25. I am completely unprejudiced. Go ahead and tell me your vicious argument in favor of modern art, and I'll judge whether it is valid or not. Does anyone have a vicious argument and motive? In this case, yeah.
It's a question begging.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say it's a question begging epithet and also petitio.
It's what petitio is.
Or, yeah, that.
I guess in some way petitio is the general name for begging the question. Then there's a bunch of things that come underneath it, such as arbitrary redefinition, circular reasoning, in this case, question begging epithet. So, yeah, I mean, and you're right, Melissa, to me on the fact that it's a vicious argument, it's a motive, and in this case, the epithet. And you can't call an argument vicious unless you know it's valid. Then you can. So, you know, first if you establish that the argument is fallacious and the premises, then you can go on and state that it's vicious. So who are you to judge whether the argument is valid or not? Well, by using logic and analyzing the premises being put forth, you can come to understand what might be being argued in the first place, the definitions. Validity is a function of, Melissa goes on to say, yeah, validity is a function of truth, of premises, and structure of argument. Right. It's the truth. And that's why first, you know, that's why it's grammar. First, we identify with something and then we use logic, to come to understanding, remove the contradictions, how, understand how each part relates to one another. And then once we have that understanding, we can transport that as wisdom. And that's so crucial. It maintains in that order. First, grammar, the identification, and then use ratios or reason, hold two different ideas in your head and kind of bounce them back and forth. And then,
and I would note that, for instance, on the Wikipedia Trivium page, it states logic, grammar, rhetoric. But the reason that grammar comes first is because truth is not found in a single word. Truth is found in words used in context of other words, right? And if you don't understand those words and what is actual knowledge in the first place, connecting the knowledge, you know, the way that Trivium is broken is when they put logic first and they have you make these connections without verifying and taking out the arbitrary.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest problem with the education system right now. When I was analyzing, I've been thinking a lot recently about my own education and what happened and such, and I realized I think they gave us logic first, especially in math. They gave us logic before the grammar. And logic, in that order, you're going to get logic, rhetoric, and then grammar. And I realized that was done not just in math, but through a lot of the curriculum I had. So they tried to give us the connections first, and the grammar is just implied.
And that's when Christians use the Trivium, it's usually logic first, which is by avoiding the grammar of what is and is not truth, they can establish these logical connections, which they'll never question the grammar in the second or third step.
And the grammar is just that basic first identification. And then,
in other words, if you had a junkyard and you're looking for a certain thing, you'd want to take out the certain thing and then organize that certain thing, not organize the junkyard and then try to remove all the things that you don't want. You know what I'm saying? Like you'd be organizing a bunch of things that you don't really need to organize. If you dismiss the arbitrary, you can get through that first. And you dismiss the arbitrary by identifying that which you're looking for, which is law of identity.
Yeah, that's a good point, Cody, actually. Well, moving a little bit up, if he was unprejudiced, then why would he identify the argument as vicious? I remember just reading this today, and it's a certain fallacy, but in stating immediately just attacking the position by saying it's vicious like that, you know, assumes.
It is an indicator of his irrationality because he's judging and characterizing an argument he hasn't yet heard. Do you get that? Like, it means he's intellectually bankrupt on the face of it.
Exactly. So number 26, you must sign the legislation raising price supports for farm products, Mr. President. It is a perfectly sound law. Remember that farm organizations in five states have announced that if you veto this bill, they will work for your opponent in the coming election.
It's the threat of force or fraud, you know, ad baculum. It's a
ad baculum, yeah.
Use of the staff against him.
Yeah, exactly. Again, this is another pretty straightforward example. When it comes to baculum, I think it's pretty easy to be able to point out when physical harm is being implied or any type of harm to the physical body, even if it's to the mind. So is that a threat? Yeah, so it's all baculum. Number 29, moving on. You asked me to give you a valid argument to prove the truth of the law of contradiction. That's simple. Whether it's presupposed by all knowledge must be true, and the law of contradiction is presupposed by all knowledge. Therefore, I infer that the law of contradiction must be true. Well, Melissa Simeon says, what about the other states? What about those paying the subsidy through tax that aren't in the form or that aren't in the farm organizations, the circular reasoning? Well, in this case, the number 20, well, yeah, number 29, he says circular reasoning, but he says petitio. I picked it up as circular reasoning, but I don't know if he ever defined it. He just said miscellaneous, but then he went on to say circular reasoning. I kind of got confused, so.
And adjacently, like implicitly, it could also be ad baculum because law depends on the threat or use of force. And right. Why is the law the law? Because the law says so, because of threat or, you know, threat of force or fraud, etc. So there's a bunch of different irrationalities that come to commingle in actual meanings of these words together.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I never thought about, you know, the presupposition of what law actually means and is defined by. It's set up to assume that harm will be committed against certain
people. If my process weren't to do the grammar first, I wouldn't have these concepts of, you know, when I come across the word law and I'm like, what does law mean, right? And so I put it together as I go through the whole sentence, and then it jumps out. The irrationalities jump out, like, in general, and then you try to add these specific names to what is the form of this irrationality, which is the fallacy that we're describing.
That's right. If your conclusion is the law of contradiction, then the structure of reasoning is such and such is true, such and such is true. Now, since the law of contradiction is true, therefore the law of contradiction is true. So that means you're just assuming the point at issue. This is more of a Patidio circuit reasoning. By the sheer act of reasoning, you are appealing to the law of contradiction in order to justify your inference. So any attempt to prove the laws of logic would commit a Patidio. So yeah, I mean, by that method. And you do that to make a certain work impregnable. He goes on to mention again. To make it so that,
and sometimes when you see these fallacies, it's not that what they're trying to communicate is incorrect. It's just that they are not done in that process. It has yet to be defined or refined. You see what I'm saying? So right. You could actually get to the point that some people are trying to make by taking out their fallacies. And it depends. It's like, what's their intent? When my intention is to continue improving and learning, when someone's trying to point out a fallacy, then I'm like, if there's a fallacy, I want to get rid of it too. Right? Whereas when some people are like, I don't care about fallacies, and they call you names and use a bunch of other fallacies, right? Which is amusing. You have to question why you're investing your time in that conversation, but you know, it's a whole different intention. So it's more about finding people who are interested in improving their communication and thinking skills, and leaving these other people who just want to argue with themselves because they talk about nothing all day. You know, whether you're there or not. I mean, what's going on in their mind is always like that. That's a hasty
What is logic? The art of non-contradictory identification. All these fallacies are just helping us try to get to what's being identified in a certain proof or statement being put forth. Again, this identification. And that's why, you know, in this case, taking objective identification is going to allow you to talk about something that has relationship to both you and everyone else around you that, you know, is observing that same fact. It's just so basic, you think, because what Socrates said, you know, get back to your definitions, understand what's being defined in the arguments. Because many people just, they don't properly define it. And in this case, it shows that a lot of this is present or implicit through logical fallacies. They just help us kind of identify where a lot of these misidentifications are.
Now, David says, Rich, regarding the general word law, I'd like to say, is this referring to natural law as opposed to coerced law? Well, that's a good question. But even natural law uses forces. It's enforced by itself, the natural laws of gravity, et cetera, right? So you don't really have a choice to break them yet, you know. So it's different aspects, of course, because one's created by man and they use real police and military and stuff like this. But as far as natural law, you still have these natural laws of physics that are logically derived and describe the system in which we live pretty accurately and can always be improved. But you know, so there's natural laws, but you still don't have the choice to really break them. You can deviate from them, but only so long, and those deviations have a cause and effect relationship, which again goes back to logic.
And coerced law in this fact would be like man's law, I would think. When private property was introduced, probably with subsistence farming and larger building of civilizations, I would just think that over time, law had to be enforced as a method by which to protect individual rights, but that presupposes
You look into the actual word law, it gets even more ironic because there's the word, there's a prefix in the Black's Law Dictionary. You can look it up. It's under J-U-S, and this would say man's law, and then the opposite is F-A-S, which is, you know, the basis of fascism, which is supposed to be God's law. But then they don't define God in the Black's Law Dictionary. They'll use words like human being or human soul or something like that, but then they don't define these words in other places. So, you know, those are the shortcomings of that definitionary resource.
Yeah, well stated. Yeah, I saw that on the the video you had up with Alex Jones and I forget his name, but he's talking about Teutonic Zionism and Just and Foss as in the Black's Law Dictionary.
Sure, Jordan Maxwell, and it's on the Hanseatic Empire, Hanseatic Empire, which was
the Hanseatic League Templars.
A guild of merchants, very much like the Fortune 100 today. So it's an international guild of merchants. So all I would observe from that is that what's going on today is just an advanced adult form of things which spawned hundreds of years ago.
Okay, so I think we just finished 29. Okay, so moving on to 33. Of course, this is an important news story. The New York Times gave it 6 columns on the front page.
Appeal to popularity? Appeal to an appeal to authority, because New York Times plus popularity, how does that fall?
Yeah, I mean, in this case,
Verecundium?
Peikoff says Verecundium, but yeah.
Yeah, but it's got there's another element there to it because of the amount. How do you classify an appeal to amount? Is that just popularity, right?
That would be populism in the form of quantitative, right? But you can't identify it just the amount is large. In this case, so, well, it gave it six columns on the front page.
And it leads, so truly, it leads with a persuasive conclusion.
Of course.
Yeah. Which is almost an appeal to ridicule. Like, of course, it's one of these things where if you don't, you know, of course, it's obvious, you know, where they lead you like this. And if, you know, they kind of slant it uphill, so if you want to start disagreeing, they've already stacked the deck against you.
You know, this, again, Jan, you bring up a good point, the fact that with Verecundium, here's another example where Verecundium and appeal to populum, and Rich pointed out, actually ridicule as well. But I think of ad populum as well can be derived from this, and they're an appeal to ridicule, and the fact, of course, is an important news story, assuming that the New York Times, first of all, being read by millions of people, so it's assumed that, you know, since the populace believes it's a good, you know.
It's also an implicit claim that the number of columns has some relationship to the importance of a news story, indicating that the New York Times is not a business run for corporate profit. You see what I'm saying? Like, there's that whole neglected aspect of this as well.
Yeah, no, that's extremely.
The point is, it's not so much about calling out the right fallacy. It's about justifying your observations of what fallacies are there. Because if you can justify them beyond somebody's ability to, you know, justify their use of the fallacy, then you can at least defend yourself.
Yeah, I think the important statement there is just being able to justify why you've come to the conclusion of that fallacy within such a statement or proposition being put forth. Because, I mean, it doesn't really matter as long as you're able to justify and then identify some of the issues with the statement. You can move on from there and just get to what's actually being talked about, or if nothing's being talked about, you can walk away. Again, it's, you know, it's identification. So going to number 34, yeah. Philosophers have tried for millennia to prove the existence of a supernatural dimension. I admit that all their arguments so far have been invalid, but no one has yet disproved their viewpoint either. Maybe, therefore, they are right.
A, it's not an argument, because he says maybe, and therefore it's not an assertion of an argument.
Yeah, that's right. No actual, the claims being put forth do not presuppose the proof. Well, the idea is that there's nothing, by saying, having that word maybe, totally changes what's being identified, because he hasn't himself identified what he's trying to prove at all.
So it's argument ad ignorantium, because it's the refusal to make a choice in a situation where there is enough information to make a choice. So it's not argument.
The onus of proof is asserted on the person who asserts the positive, right?
Yeah, it's not nescience. They're ignorant in this case.
And they admit it.
with their uncertainty. So that's the other thing. When you see someone trying to make an argument and they're not using words in their premise that, you know, indicate an argument at the end. So yeah. There's uncertainty. So that there's a lack of self-confidence, which means there's a lack of understanding and experience in that area. So these are red flags that, again, should let you know. You can't necessarily take this and store it as valid information. You're going to have to look beyond the label on the box, open it up, inspect the contents, make sure they're not broken or cracked, right? So, you know, it's about not just buying something and putting it on the shelf and assuming what's in the box is as labeled, if I can use the inventory metaphor.
Yeah, if you say the words like I think or I believe or maybe, you're kind of leaving it open to doubt. And if you're stating an argument of essays, they'd always tell us never to use such trigger words, because that just, what you're saying is then something hasn't been properly, in your case, something hasn't been properly identified. It's just assumed that, you know, a certain conclusion might be true, but it doesn't, you still have to provide the evidence to assert that proof.
And as far as argumentum ad ignorantium, it's a case where you can't disprove, therefore it's irrational, you know, it's you know, you can't disprove it, therefore it's possible, is the fallacy. And it's because you can't disprove it that you have to understand that whoever makes the positive assertion has the burden of proof, and that you can't disprove a negative.
Exactly. And like in this case, yeah, we're just saying there's trigger words you could actually look for to more aptly be able to identify it more quickly. Yeah, Melissa Simeon, the onus of proof is on the one that asserts absence of proof for or against means ignore the argumenter. Exactly. So.
And that also includes the idea that you're talking about nothing with a person who has very little knowledge that's useful in this area. So why are you having this conversation if identity hasn't been made, right? So it's like about hypotheses. And, you know, if the meeting that this conversation is going on in is about let's discuss our dreams last night, then it's appropriate. But if you're actually trying to get some quantifiable progress or meaningful constructive action out of anybody, it does not start with use of fallacies in this way. which is why it's important, because then you can get down to working with the people who are serious and dismiss the arbitrary ideas that keep people running in circles for the past decade about some of the most major problems to face humanity.
Many times keep them running in circles about to not even look at the problems that are facing humanity. Number 35. Bill is a marvelous person. I always enjoy myself in his company. I disagree. I think he's awful. It depresses me just to be in the same room with him. Yeah, so in this case, like, I'll just go ahead and take this one. It's appeal to one's own emotion. So the fact that you enjoy yourself in his company doesn't prove that he's marvelous, which is an objective value estimate that might be hyperbolized. Just because someone doesn't like being in his company doesn't mean that he's no good either. So
I have a question about this, though. All right, so it says Bill is a marvelous person. I always enjoy myself in his company. Okay, so this other person's disagreeing, so they're trying to make an argument. Well, by what other metric would you test whether or not Bill is a marvelous person? I mean, isn't that a subjective opinion anyway?
Yeah.
There is no objective opinion about making Bill a marvelous person if you're not how much you enjoy spending time with this dude. So it's kind of, again, Peikoff in 76 or whenever he wrote this, I don't know if he could have spent a couple more minutes making that one, because that's kind of an ill-formed example if you're expressing to try to educate the appeal to emotions and the subjective value of that content. But I get what he's saying.
Melissa Simeone said the same thing. Subjective categoricals mean something only to the speaker. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, Rich. And Peikoff also,
in other words, they don't communicate. They're proprietary transmissions, which are basically meaningless, and that's arbitrary and irrational to take as knowledge.
Yeah, there's a problem with identifying, well, with the idea of marvelous. Well, I mean, it goes back to being subjective. It's all arbitrary. It's based on your own interpretation of how you feel around that person, but it doesn't have, how do you, like you said, Rich, what's the metric you use to objectively
If the sentence
identify?
Read, Bill is a virtuous person, that is something that could be objectively measured, because you can understand if Bill's needs, which, and his actions to meet those needs are in integrity. If he's a virtuous person, then his needs are being met before his wants. He's not a virtuous person if he's gambling away his money every week and making his family starve and he's losing his house. That's not virtue. Your actions are out of line with your needs. So there's a definition that's objective. You can work through that whole thing. But the idea of marvelous is a subjective connotation, and one can't even establish an argument or entertain it. It's unmeasurable, as David notes.
Yeah, that's extreme. That's a good point. Good observation there as to the problem with the actual question. Yeah, Peikoff, he definitely, another thing he's done a lot of, I thought, is his objectivistic rhetoric. I guess that comes without saying. He said he wouldn't promote it too much, but it's been pretty much one massive promotion for Ayn Rand and the objectivist school of thought, I thought, going through a lot of these. Of course, you're going to refer back to what you always argue with anyways. It's just funny.
Here's my point. When he does that, it just shows that there's more to be learned, because if it was obviously as useful as it can be, you wouldn't need to do any of that. You understand? It's like if there's something that's obviously useful, you don't need advertising for it. You don't need to make up these little things and take little jabs. You know what I'm saying? You don't need to debunk or defame anybody. You can just lead people by discovering. And so in these places where you notice him doing that, that's just the shortcoming of him at that point of his life, at that night when he was recording that session under those circumstances. So it's just something
we
can all learn from.
Like I said, lead people to discovering it. Yeah, that's what Gene was trying to do with the trivium, just give it out to people and let them kind of discover, ease it for themselves. And
in other words, like there are legitimate reasons to rail against Marx or Engels. But you should reasons should be laid out in a certain way so as not to try to debunk or disprove, because then that just opens you up to someone else coming along and trying to debunk or disprove you. And if all of our goals become, let's just discover beyond what's already been discovered and figure out what we've discovered that's not really true and work backwards and then go forward again after we get the correct, analysis of this. But, I don't think it's a competitive thing. I just think that, If you're truly learning anything in this world, you have to stand on the shoulders of giants who have actually done their work and sifting and filtering and delivering some knowledge at points in their life and making it preserved somehow in media, right? Otherwise, we'd be limited to what we have direct experience of, and that's very little.
Well, this all builds on what's been built in the past. So, yeah, standing on the shoulders of giants is a perfect analogy for that situation. And we have to be able to understand, identify what they've done, both correctly and incorrectly, and then hopefully improve it and move on from there. And so, I mean, objectivist is just taking Aristotle's philosophy and kind of using.
And that's another reason I don't think it should be demonized, because it is just a modern representation and recirculation of Aristotle's work with some new observations and improvements that may go beyond his work in some areas. And in other areas, they may fall behind what he had actually discovered, and they might have slipped back a couple steps. But the important thing is that any objective reader can go through this and make these discoveries on their own without falling into, you know, the Randroid
cult. Right, and just through identification and a simple idea as cause and effect, which, you know, goes back thousands of years. So just understanding those two things, I think you can start moving forward, and you don't have to fall into the Iran cult in some of the way, because, I mean, well, there's so many issues there. I mean, using critical thinking, but seeing they're using critical thinking, especially in the Iran think tank, and then, you know, supporting so many illogical capitalist assumptions, free market assumptions. But, you know, that's one example of where I think they fall short. Also, the foreknowledge of 9/11 and what's happened afterwards, the Rand Corporation is extended in that. So, I mean, yeah.
Cody asks, are the neo-aristocrats the Randroids? Well, the Randroids would be people who take objectivism as an extreme form, as you know, to an extreme area, and thereby become irrational.
Well, and ironically, the entire objectivist philosophy is created by Rand, but then it's like it became a cult in and of itself.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, you know, you need to be objective, and people need to understand induction rather than deduction, but...
Yes,
to say that one is wholly invalid over the other or under the other, I think, is the problem, although that could be a middle-of-the-road fallacy. But
and the other mistake is that even though it's a useful tool, it's only useful once you come to understand it, and it's not an entire solution. You still need to read, like, Seneca and discover how to deal with anger and other things that come in, because even if you have logic, it doesn't mean you're not going to get angry or frustrated or bitter over these things, right? So there are many other people who have contributed. Just as I would just say that Rand's work stands out in the 20th century because, A, it is so simply prolific in bringing these gems of the past and putting them together and you know, giving people a new presentation of this. Also, it's remarkable in so far as how many bad guys like Greenspan and these other guys, you know, claim to use Randian philosophy, and what they do is they take it into an extreme form. They take it into serving themselves and themselves only and breaking all these other rules of logic that are in objectivism, right? So they take like a bastardized straw man form, and then that gives Rand a bad name, which kept Jan and I and several other people away from looking at her work too closely because we didn't want to become like them. I even attacked her in one of my films. That was only like 2 years ago. And I was accurate in my attack as it was in that context. But in a bigger context, if I had never said, well, maybe I'm wrong, let me take a real look at this, you know, and keep an open mind and use the trivium, I might have never discovered some of the most useful tools that I've encountered in the past several weeks studying these different definitions in the lexicon, which are very clear and succinct. Her definitions of communism, socialism, all these sorts of things, as juxtaposed to the history I've learned before this, are all right in line. When she describes socialism, it's all about taking away individual will, individual anything, your right to own the work that you do, right? And so when you see English socialism then sponsor not national socialism, that's the Nazis. English socialism also sponsored international socialism. That's the communists. That's the USSR, right? So these are all coming from a thin layer of people who used ideas that these were going on before Ayn Rand even got down to her work. But her first couple books were funded by Philip Rothschild. So they were trying to get this philosophy for themselves, and they saw they could use it any way they want once they could justify their position, right? And so it was created. It was all brought here to serve them. They didn't bring it here thinking that people in the year 2011 were going to have a study group on the internet and all go through this for ourselves. And it's only used as a weapon against us as long as we're all ignorant of what's going on. And there are several ways that we can help bolster our intellectual self-defense by getting familiar with these subjects without ever having to become these things.
We make an interesting point of rationalizing. They can use this then against other people, and that's the point. But, you know, I have to say,
because if you don't know it well enough to call them out when they're doing it, then you're like, well, they're really smart. They must be, you know, it must be okay for Greenspan to do that or Bernanke or whoever, right?
Right. And there's a bunch of, like you stated, what you've been missing with the noble law is, you know, for example, population, overpopulation, or the idea that then they made this fake scientific, you know, announcement that of global warming to help support that condition, so forth and so on. And
Melissa Simeon notes the Bohemian Grove ceremony of the cremation of care held every summer in July as an outgrowth of the objectivist make self happy, right? And that could be, but it would be a straw man form. I would note that the cremation of care, like I have Bohemian Grove plays that were from the 20s and the teens. So that was going on before Rand kind of made the scene and changed her name and, you know, hung out with Rothschild and stuff like that. So the idea that they do have this practice that comes from ancient Babylon, comes from Canaan, the worship of Molech, etc., where once a year they can just cremate their care. So it's like they build up a bunch of guilt, maybe, if they're not total psychopaths, and then they cremate it, which is kind of psychopathic. But it's no more of an out there idea as being able to take communion and get forgiven by forgiven your sins by saying some rosaries. Is that what they're called? I'm not Catholic, but I've seen movies where people confess and then they're forgiven of their sins. It's a common theme in movies.
Right, yeah, you have to go to confession, then the priest is the medium through which you can be, the grace of God can have those, your sins removed from you. And you have to go say a penance, usually. The priest determines the penance, though, based on the severity of the crime, or crimes, against your, you know, against God. So yeah, it's exactly the same. Casting ashes of cremated dead relatives in favored places is just as weird, and many of us do it. You know, it's interesting with the cremation of care, how it's done in effigy to essentially burn the idea of any care they might have for the destruction that they're doing to the world. And
well, actually, in the casting of ashes, I'd note that there's a physical circulation system that goes on in nature. Like this past week, there was this movie I checked out, and it's what happens when an elephant dies. And in about a week, this 5,000-pound elephant's gone, right? And so there are physical cause and effect circulations, how would you say, convection currents of causality, right? So the termination or the exit of a spirit from a body and the reclamation of that energy into the surrounding system is a physical, objective phenomenon. And the casting away of sins is a subjective, irrational phenomenon that is brokered by these people who need money, because their God needs money. I don't know what that's all about. But the God I believe in isn't short of cash, mister.
Yeah, they need money or gold or marble or, you know, all these different, going to the Vatican when I was younger. And
they want to build these buildings like they're going to build something that's cooler than what's already outside and growing. You know what I'm saying? The planet
exactly.
Is like the planet's like the church, and every time I see people like huddled into a building on Sunday with windows that have colored glass or no windows at all, so that you have to pay attention to this one dude in the front who has no logic or reason. Otherwise, he wouldn't be up in the front of a group of people from whom he might be learning and trying to tell them like he thinks it is, to condition them into passing around a plate and giving him some money so he cannot have to work. Right? That's a crazy situation on the face of it.
Well, it's an insult to ourselves. And, you know, through critical thinking, we can actually come to identify that if we remain open enough.
It's kind of an insult to the creator, because you're not using the brain that the creator, the intelligence of this nature, of this environment, gave us. And gave us the ability to learn our way out of these things, at least. Thank God.
Well said. Well said. Okay, so I guess, which one were we just on, 35?
We were on 37. You hadn't read the quote yet.
Okay.
We talked about the quote before we read it.
So number 37, okay. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, the Communist Manifesto, but don't wrangle with us so long as you apply. To our intended abolition of bourgeoisie's property, the standard of your...
It's pronounced bourgeois.
Bourgeois property. The standard of your bourgeois notions of freedom, culture, law, etc.
Yeah, you get corrected here instead of in a live interview with Paul.
Well, no, I appreciate the correction. Don't want to try to pronounce that. But but don't wrangle with us so long as you apply to our intended abolition of bourgeois property, the standard of your bourgeois notions of freedom, culture, law, etc. Your very ideas are about the outgrowth of your bourgeois production and bourgeois property, just as your jurisprudence is, but the will of your class made into a law for all. A will whose essential character and direction are determined by the economic conditions of existence of your class.
I would note that the repetition of the word bourgeois indicates that a judgment has been made without observation, because it's used as like a weapon the whole way through that sentence, you know, like it's being thrown at you.
They're assuming a definition for bourgeois that implies like an ad hominem abusive sort of attack. And so therefore we don't have to define bourgeois, but the way it's being used and kind of asserted at you as this kind of attack, this sword swinging at you, kind of gives the context for why in this case it would be an ad hominem, in this case abusive. Moses Simeon says, your very ideas are but the outgrowth, false cause, loaded terms that presuppose bourgeois. Cody V says, circular reasoning without evidence presupposing bourgeois is a bad thing.
It also appears that the authors of this quote seek to make an impression and to create a divide in the audience. They're not trying to build bridges here. They're trying to blow up bridges. That's what me thinks from reading this passage.
Could they be leading to a false alternative in this case?
I don't know what's going to happen. I didn't catch up on communism after they wrote this book. I don't know what happens after that book, but it leads up. It looks like it's leading up to some bad irrationalities. I don't know if something would happen in the 20th century that would validate that observation, but just from reading that it just, you know, lets you know that there's something going on there. Seems to divide and conquer. That's what that paragraph is saying.
An old tactic still continually used.
It's like taunting an enemy before you even attack them. That's not smart.
So you remember both sides.
Not to mention that it was written by a couple of rich dudes who didn't have to go to work every day. So that, you know, there's that hypocrisy that they were put up to it by other rich people to do it, because they were like the working rich class. They're like worker bees, but they're still living a life of nobility.
Yeah, it's ironic when you actually put it in perspective and context of history.
And David
will change your opinion a little bit. That's kind of a neglected aspect.
David observes there's no argument that he can see. Like, the whole thing is just without merit.
That's exactly right. Okay, so moving on to number 40. You argue that happiness is possible to man. Well, you're wrong. Wait until you've lived. Anyone? This one's pretty straightforward. In this case, it's it's an abusive ad hominem. Does anyone want to hash out why? You agree that happiness is possible to man. Well, you're wrong. Wait until you've lived.
He's asserting that only people who haven't lived experience happiness.
Or he's stating that just by living, it's impossible to obtain any form of happiness. Or that the more you've lived, the more it's just entropic, chaotic, undesirable. Okay. Number 43. Of course, it's a great movie. I loved it.
Is that a metric of a good movie? I mean, that's a subjective perspective. It's only a good movie to that one person because of their emotions that they loved it. They don't have any objective demonstration or evidence or anything they can pass off useful to anyone else. So when someone says, of course it's a great movie, I loved it, unless you have a lot of similar concepts in your mind, that might not be a good movie for you.
Right, unless you, for example, with a friend, can identify certain traits you like in movies that you've watched together, or certain styles in movies, but it's still hard to, in this case, she's just subjectively identifying that for her, you know, or for whoever in this case, of course, it's a great movie, I loved it. Just because she loved it doesn't mean it's a great movie.
That's all good, but we can't take that as like knowledge for ourselves, right? Because that means you actually, it's like, how was that dinner? Oh, it was good. If you want to know for yourself, you're actually going to have a bite of the dinner or order it next time at the restaurant. Right? You can't just depend because it might have something that you don't think is good. Right? And how does it benefit you to have these perspectives or beliefs that you haven't verified? You're just causing danger for yourself in the future.
Yeah. Actually, number 44 we skipped. So yeah, we'll just jump to number 45. We'll go over 44 next week, I guess, or next lecture. So abuse number 45 would be, Aristotle defined the laws of logic in ancient Greece. We are living in the 20th century. Obviously, things have changed enormously since then, and his logic is now deficient.
I'd say prove it. That'd be my ironic answer. Prove his logic is deficient.
Is this an abusive ad hominem? I mean, that's what Peikoff states, but I guess could you say...
you could say you're talking about nothing because you can't prove it without using logic.
Yeah.
And the idea of proof comes from logic. So it'd be the concept of the stolen fallacy if that were the case.
Or just trying to put something forth in this case.
Actually, I would say this is the fallacy of the stolen concept, because it's a person who has an opinion on Aristotle, observing that we're in the 20th century, which is kind of a non sequitur, because truth doesn't have to change over time.
Right.
Some truths are relative to time, but others are truth. Obviously, things have changed enormously since then, and his logic is now deficient. Hmm. Well, that's an error in a whole bunch of other things, but that's the argument is an assertion of proof, and it lacks the logic and its structure.
That's why I'm wondering, could it be that fallacy, ignorantium, but it's not necessarily in this case, because he doesn't put forward, well...
If I was having a conversation with this person, like, all these red flags would go up, like... It says, well, in order to communicate with this person, you're going to have to say a lot of words, and they're going to have to be open to those words to actually even start to talk about something. And they're already demonstrating that they've made a judgment without observation. So what kind of investment of my time is that to, you know, sit there? I mean, like, what is my intelligence level if I'm going to sit there and discuss the arbitrary for 20 minutes with somebody who doesn't want to get to the objective?
Yeah, why waste your time in that perspective? Or if it's that far behind, you just have to maybe plant some seeds and just, you know, be on your way.
Now, if they want to learn, I want to learn. Cool, we're on the same page. Let's check this out. You know, that's a conversation. You know what I'm saying? That's what people are missing in their texts and all these other things going on today. The actual conversations of things that lead to relevant conclusions that are objective and useful to more than one person. That's the idea of interchangeable parts and the logical metaphor that is, you know, our ability to communicate about useful things that are meaningful to more than one person. We need our interchangeable parts of logic, and the interchangeable parts in this case are the definitions on which we agree at some point in order to have communication.
Well, definitions allow you to identify. That'd be grammar first, and then once you move from there, you can have kind of a dialectic, maybe back and forth process to try to find the logic in it.
Once you do that, you can discover anything.
Yep. No matter how hard or difficult the subject might be, it's really not that difficult if you analyze the grammar first and then slowly move through the logic. It's really that simple. But many topics can take a long time, but having this method really makes a lot of the uncertainty kind of dissipate from such. I guess we just did 45. It's number 46. Capitalism is the right system of government because it promotes the freedom of the individual. Individual freedom is good because it enhances the individual's ability to produce. And production is a good thing because without it, we can never maintain the free enterprise system.
This argument is inaccurate on the face of it because capitalism attracts predators and corruption, and it doesn't have an adequate system to maintain its integrity yet. And that's why we have the economic folly of today. So he's pitching something. He believes this, but he doesn't understand why things the way they are, because he hasn't put out a theory of corruption in our society. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
This is the invisible leech that causes the imbalance that we're seeing all the time. It's like, where does all the money go? Oh, that's the hole in the bucket that is the corruption that
is money and how is money used? Oh, it's something as simple as that. Let's not look there. But
it seems like money is something they print and you get charged for. That's an interesting concept.
Charged to use, right? Usury. There's some comments made here. Melissa Simeone said, I think this is going back to the last question. What does the speaker wish to address that Aristotelian logic isn't appropriate for? Is it relevant? I guess it goes back to Dave Leneff's statement of irrelevant conclusion, I guess, in the last fallacy. Again, I think a lot of these can build out of once you start to identify more broad fallacies, you can start picking out what they could potentially lead to. So it's like a slippery slope of fallacies. But I don't know if it necessarily immediately
because
implies
once
such.
You identify one error in the line of thinking, it doesn't, you know, whether it's one or many, it's just letting you know that you're not going to consider this to be 100% knowledge. That's, you know, it's just these degrees of certainty that allow you from attaining an extreme position. Because all these people who, you know, take up an extreme position on any of these subjects, they're doing so because they've assumed a bunch of things that they hadn't checked out. Otherwise, they'd have the humility to know that they don't know everything and that we all know so little. Like, just think of this. Think about how much we can learn in any given day. And yet we've learned for all these days before that, and there's still all this stuff to learn, and we could learn our whole lives and never even, like, scratch the surface of this, right? So that's the humility that fights off the hubris, which is the extremism. Right, these people who think they have the right to go change the lives of billions of people against their will without ever checking with them, and then seek our support for it. And that's just, you know, that's passé.
And knowing that in order to seek our support, they'll have to manipulate our minds because they know that mass support of this would be hard to garner unless you can create false dichotomies and use tons of different types of fallacies to perpetuate different memes and sections within a society. So, okay, moving on to number 49. No, we're on 49. So, professor, you must raise my grade in this course, otherwise I won't be able to graduate, and that means I'll lose my job, and then what will happen to my two sick children?
Appeal to pity.
Right, yeah, everyone, Melissa, Jeff, and Jan, that's correct.
Ad misericordium, which is it's like ad baculum, only it's the use of guilt, or it's an implicit non-physical force that's being used. So it's still a form of force, only in this case, it's like a guilt trip.
Yeah, and I'd just like to note how this is a bit different from appeal to ridicule. But in this case, you're actually appearing, it has similar connotations with the idea.
It would have to go another step to be ridicule, because then, if you don't help me, then my children would be in danger, and then you'd be a child killer or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You'd be known as a child killer, you know, if you don't help me, right? Then that would be the appeal to ridicule, because you don't want to be called anything like that.
So again, another idea of slippery slopes applied to how your statement continue to be argued for can lead to a whole host of different fallacies from ones that have already been identified. Okay, so now moving on to number 57. I think we're just about done here. Okay, number 57. This man claims that he remembers his former life, the past life, people, in which he was the Pharaoh of Egypt. I believe him, and you can't prove that he wasn't. This one will be pretty obvious. Can he prove that he was?
Argumentum ad ignorantium, because you can't prove a negative. The burden of proof says he who asserts that he used to be the Pharaoh has to provide some objective evidence if he requires the belief or understanding or knowledge of someone other than himself. If he just wants to keep that for himself, great, don't spread it to anyone else. But anyone he tries to spread it to needs to say, hey, wait a minute, you're asserting the positive, so let's check this out.
And if anyone tries to say if he can prove it and tries to do so, he's actually not identifying. Everything's arbitrary in his proof because it's completely subjective to his own way of does not relate to anything you can identify with your five senses. It's some type of experience he had, therefore subjective to him. And you can't actually identify, therefore, objectively. And so, therefore, he needs to be able to identify that and present it to you in a way that you can relate and see for yourself, which would be, in this case, impossible.
And it's the same fallacy that when Louis C.K. asked Rumsfeld, if he's a lizard, prove you're not a lizard, this sort of stuff. Rumsfeld doesn't respond because you can't disprove a negative. So he's not asserting he is or isn't, and it's up to the person. And he just leaves his voice basically off the record on that topic in that interview. So it just shows how clever the people who are in control are at rhetoric and being able to use Jesuitical argument stylings to keep away from the point. And I think Louis C.K. is also pretty intelligent for putting that line of questioning out there in front of somebody who's smart enough to recognize it and kind of joust with him in an entertaining way. Because I don't think Rumsfeld is a reptile. I think he's somebody without empathy for others and lacks compassion and might have some psychopathic tendencies. That there's evidence for all these things, right? So, you know, but a reptile, I don't see any evidence for that. But
yeah,
I can't prove he's not, though.
Well, you know, it's clever on Louis C.K.'s part that he goes ahead and states it in that way, because then it's like you said, it goes to show how they're well-versed and trained to be able to joust with that type of absurd questioning being put forward. Because, like, just by him jumping into that would create a whole host of issues that he didn't want to jump into in the first place, or because it can lead to just ridiculous.
That all being said. With that all being said, when Paul Verge called me and asked me, I was like, no, I'm not a reptile, dude. He's like, see, you would answer it. So I think most of us would answer it because we don't seek to obscure the nature of whether or not we're reptiles. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Well,
Rumsfeld, in his case, because he's a political figure, he doesn't want to fuel any fires by saying anything about it. And he's just saying, at my advanced age, I've already been bitten by that worm a couple times, and he's learned. Right.
He's been through that, especially on the deal with the media. Yep, the comedian. It was on the end of the One Peace Revolution podcast. I don't know what number was it. Was it number the 4-hour one?
24, maybe. It's at the
no,
end.
No, no, no. It's
World War One, maybe?
No, it's the one after that. Yeah, the neocon. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the neocons one, but that's not the proper title, so that's not going to help anybody.
It was recent. It was at like the very, very end. It was right after the neocon. The whole segment pretty much takes up the podcast. Number 58, employee. What is the reason for filling out these forms in triplicate? Employer, you'll be fired if you don't. I'm just going to state this one. It's argumentum ad baculum. Pretty obvious again in this example.
They give you a threat rather than presenting some sort of evidence.
Right.
And by the way, the Peace Revolution episode that talks about that is episode 22, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy. And it's at the end of that episode, I believe, where Louis C.K., because it covers Rumsfeld in his early years during the episode. So then in recent juxtaposition of the creation of that episode, the Louis C.K. interview happened, and we had listened to it. So I was like, I'm going to put that at the end, because that also ties in with the logic study group that we're doing now.
It's good you did. I didn't pick that up in the first. I mean, I implicitly knew why he was dodging the question in the form of not wanting to get caught in that type of arbitrary type of discussion that could lead to a whole bunch of ridiculous outcomes that have nothing to do with what he's done in the past. But yeah, it's now that you made it explicit in how it works through logic, I can see how it relates more and more. Okay, so moving on, I guess, number 60. Societies disagree profoundly with one another as to what constitutes good and evil. This shows that objective truth and ethics can never be known by man.
Truth is not determined by consensus. It's not a valid form of discerning what is fact or fiction. That's the first error. I don't know if you want to name that a fallacy. Peikoff didn't intend to, otherwise he would have written a better question, or assertion, argument.
Yeah, he says it's an indirect form of argumentum ad verecundium. I guess in the idea that the majority of this country regards abstract philosophy as a waste of time. Of course, and if you're appealing to authority, therefore, as a man dedicated to freedom, you must accept and abide by the majority's view on this question. But yeah, I guess you could call it indirect. I mean, there's, I think, a ton of fallacies present within here. A populum. Also, there's some type of, it's not necessarily ridicule, but you are attacking a bit like a waste of time, saying that somehow this majority regards philosophy as a waste of time. Begs the question of what truth is, of what is truth compared to good and evil. that's actually a brilliant question or brilliant point you make there, Cody.
Well, truth could be an objective anchor where, you know, that people can reference. It could be an objective reference point, whereas good and evil can usually in everyday people's thinking, it's a subjective term based on their subjective position, which is part of the fallacy that leads to their irrationality in the first place.
Right. But how does truth, that objective anchor, relate to the subjective interpretation of good and evil, and how good and evil relates to the subjective understanding of what truth is?
Well, good and evil may be, you know, they're tied to your needs and your virtues and your morals and your ethics, how you go about meeting your needs, right? And so it's, first off, you can't judge yourself as a good or evil person in that circumstance because the other people around you are judging you and you're judging them. So there's a whole bunch of other things that are going on with relation to your order of observation and logic and rhetoric, and, you know, this sort of thing. So.
Lissa Simeon says, I feel a little insulted to be told that myself and others are not capable, competent to determine good and evil.
Well, that's the whole idea of government, because they make the decisions for us. We're not competent to make our day-to-day discernments. And in some ways that's true, but they're the ones who broke our ability to see these things, because, you know, there was a time when people could recognize that they were under the reign of a insane king who was 2,000 plus miles away, and that they as free men shouldn't have to obey some idiot on the other side of the world who wears costumes and gets a bunch of other people to believe in that act. That's common sense.
Extremely well said. Going on still today, just in a more, I guess you can just say, an updated form.
Tom Paine had a, you know, there's a lot of things that he observed back then that are identical to what's going on today. So, you know, common sense, you know, that truth, that objective truth through which multiple people could relate, you know, it wasn't just some subjective assertion. It's something that people could relate to. That has resonance through time. And, you know.
Yeah, I remember in English class in 10th grade, the teacher was telling us about how, just for, I guess, the example she uses, King Henry VIII, and everyone knew that he was batshit crazy, but, that they still allowed him to remain his power, and they just kind of like would watch him go about his day and just would talk about behind his back, but no one would make it explicit. you know, it goes back to that old story about, you know, king wears the little child saying that, you know, the king has no clothes. Well, it's going from what everyone already knows to be true to actually stating the actual truth behind it, making it explicit. Imagine if we did that now. Cody B, it sure is a nice costume, though. So many hats. Yeah, you gotta love how they dress up and put on plays for us, right? Just like the wedding. I think the military kind of dresses up and does that as well. They just don't realize they're being misled.
Well, if they did, would they sign up for those? You know, it's a crazy thing, especially when most of the guys signing up for the military realize that their recruiters are lying to them, but they're going anyway.
They over-rationalize the idea of commitment to U.S. what USA is supposed to stand for and what they're failing to identify in this case, the idea that there isn't something more ominous behind some of the conclusions as to why we went to some of the recent wars we did. And in doing so, you make a justification for what's being presented to you so you can justify your reasoning for being in the war or helping out, being in the Army or Marines or whatever, when in fact you're not actually remaining open enough to really identify the real causes and root problems of why we're, you know, for example, over in Afghanistan or Iraq or now in Libya.
The whole thing, the whole military mission in the past decade is based on paradoxes. And if these paradoxes were made aware, I doubt anybody would be willing to risk their lives for them.
No, but that's a brilliant statement, because if people could just think of history. If you analyze history and the wars that especially have happened in the 20th century, you come to a completely different picture behind the people that contrived the situations. And when you do so, I mean, that's tough to look at, considering, you know, my grandfather fought in World War II and all these types of things. Now understanding some of the underlying machinations behind those events, you kind of realize, well, when you have that unocculted version of history, that neglected aspect all of a sudden coming back and giving you a totally different conclusion from the one you stated, if people can come to recognize that history and then see how that history still is in effect to today and how it leads up to what we're experiencing today, people wouldn't go for those wars. I mean, if the information is there and they're able to filter it out themselves, I think that people do take the more rational step. But then, yeah, you have to have multiple steps here. I mean, Edward Bernays, he did all that research on whether or not people act more rationally or backed on their unconscious desires, you know, based on sexuality or our basic fears of darkness and all these types of things. But in that case, you still have to remove the basic rudiments, the basic underlying factors, in this case the trivium, to really make it that effective. By then, the Prussian education system had already been under its way in America. So, I mean, there are certain factors that lead to why those men would start acting irrational. That was set up from the time they were young. So, like, if we were just to give all this information out to people, most people would just call us crazy conspiracy theorists, or would just say they would refuse to look at it because they haven't themselves been given the tools. And if you're telling someone for 30 or 40 years that everything they've been taught and believed was pretty much a lie, and they allowed their life to be lived that way, but the way you state it sounds that really bad, they're going to resist it. So it's allowing them to remain open just to kind of have that possibility, remain open enough to identify some of the things they might not want to believe themselves. So I guess that just all goes together. It is sickening when camo fabrics and dog tags become the trend with kids and they change color scheme according to the terrain of the country we're quote unquote helping. Yeah, Melissa, that's that's extremely sad. And that's, I guess, a prospect of the times we live in.
It's a whole fashion now, military clothing.
You know, I was thinking about, Jeff, you're still on the call, what you said the last week about the education situation. Remember, I forgot to bring this up. There's a instance where I was in college and I attended this study group. It's a PhD student put together, and it was the study group was centered around, we had to kind of brainstorm ideas about why cheating is on such a rampant rise in our culture. And, you know, we went back to this idea of this artificial sense of unhealthy competition in a way that we have to fight against one another instead of work with one another to help overcome certain situations.
Because that's not why it goes on, though. People lie and people cheat because they think they can get away with it. So there's advanced technology through which students can cheat, and the system to catch them isn't good enough. It's the exact same thing that's going on in our financial industry and in political.
Yeah, but they created the system so they know how to cheat it, right? That's the beauty behind the system that's been created. Because, like, if you make people believe in this, and it is magic in this case, the way words are used to manipulate how we relate to the world. But
the ability to commit fraud has technologically advanced beyond people's current ability to detect the frauds. And as soon as we bring that out, then we'll have a better chance.
Well said.